That, ladies and gentlemen, will call this meeting to order. This is a meeting of the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission. It's April 21st, approximately 9:30 in the morning, and we're here at the State Capitol Building. This is the time and the place noticed for this meeting. I'm Dusty Johnson. Joining me today are Commissioners Steve Kolbeck and Gary Hansen. We do have an agenda as well as an addendum. It would be my thought that we would take things a little bit out of order, saving telecom item number 2, which is the Mid-Continent request for local exchange service, to be moved to the end of the agenda. There's some confidential information. We probably want to clear the phone lines for the discussion on that. Does anybody have a problem with that? Hearing none, let's dive in. Item number 1 under administration is the approval of the minutes of the commission meetings, which were held on February 24th and March 10th. Are there any corrections to the minutes?
Move for approval.
Motion has been made. No second is required. We'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. The motions carry 3-0. This time we'll turn to Ms. Gregg for her reports on the Consumer Affairs Division.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. The Commission has received a total of 103 contacts since the last report was prepared for the April 7th, 2009 Commission meeting. 33 of the contacts involved telecommunication service, 23 of the contacts involved electric service, 3 contacts involved gas and electric services, 9 contacts involved cell phone service, 18 contacts related to the Do Not Call Registry, 1 contact was related to the Keystone XL pipeline, and 16 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 836 of the 895 complaints received in 2009 have been resolved, and 2,512 of the 2,513 complaints received in 2008 have been resolved.
Thank you, Ms. Gregg. Any questions? Hearing none, we'll proceed to electric item number 1, which does deal with Mid-American Energy Company and their request for approval of their proposed energy efficiency plan for 2008. The question before the commission today is, shall the commission approve the additional tariff changes recently filed? Mid-American.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mid-American is requesting approval of 2 changes to tariff sheets related to energy efficiency. The first change is to several electric tariff sheets to include the energy efficiency cost recovery factor in the minimum bill calculation, just as the energy cost adjustment factor is currently included. Inclusion of the energy efficiency cost recovery factor in the minimum bill calculation was inadvertently omitted when the original energy efficiency filing was made. The second change being requested is to lower the initial energy efficiency cost recovery factor for gas. At the March 24th Public Utilities Commission meeting, Mid-American was asked to revise its process and change the factor only once per year. Mid-American agreed to this change and will include the higher usage winter months in the first recovery period. Lowering the cost recovery factor will work to levelize the factor between years. Mid-American has requested these changes on less than 30 days' notice so that the changes can be implemented with the initial implementation of the energy efficiency program. Mid-American appreciates the Commission's considering these changes on short notice, and we would be happy to answer any questions you might have about our filing.
Great. Thank you very much. We'll hold questions and look to Mr. Rounds, Mr. Jacobson, Mr. Knadel, or Ms. Kramer for their comments.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. This is Dave Jacobson from staff. The first tariff change that the company spoke of is just a language change. The second change is the actual rate change, taking into account the higher volumes, as the company explained. We would recommend approval with a May 1st, 2009 effective date.
Thanks, Mr. Jacobson. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question for staff. I'm curious. I understand that you rejected the originally filed plan. What reasons did you have for that?
The originally filed plan? This filing was approved in an earlier commission meeting. I can find when that was. And these were just, are you speaking about going to the annual?
Correct.
Okay.
This is Brian Rounds for staff. Maybe about a month ago, 2 meetings ago or so, when you guys approved the Otter Tail plan, they first suggested having 2 filings for their true up. And we suggest just doing one annual filing. And so that's the reason for that change.
All right. Thank you.
Other questions?
I just missed the effective date, Dave. Could you read?
It was May 1st.
May 1st.
Those were the that was the effective date of the original tariff approvals also.
Okay. And I had the same question as Commissioner Hansen. But could you expand on why one true-up would be better than two true-ups? Is just less confusion for the customer?
Well, yeah, I think administrative ease probably and less confusion also when you because the gas is unique in having high usage in the wintertime and low usage in the summertime. If you compute your factors over an annual basis, it ends up being a more stable type of adjustment, too.
Thank you.
Other questions? Hearing none, I'll move that the commission approve the additional tariff changes on less than 30 days' notice. Any comments on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. And again, thank you to Mid-America and as part of the ongoing efforts. I know this has been quite a process, and certainly looking forward to having those programs in place for your customers. Thanks much. Electric item number 2 is the matter of the application by Buffalo Ridge 2, which is a subsidiary of Iberdrola, for their wind farm and associated collection substation and interconnection system. We did have a hearing on the matter last week, and the decision is on the agenda today for final decision. My thought was that we would try to work through some of the issues again one by one, and if anybody else has got a different approach, we can certainly adopt that as well. First, I thought that we should probably approve the stipulation that the applicant, the staff, and Brookings County had with regard to and adopt those findings of fact and conclusions of law and conditions that were part of that stipulation. Does anybody have any comments on that? With that, then we'll proceed to vote. And again, we largely reviewed this and did that at the last hearing as far as limiting the issues, but probably should adopt them formally.
I think that's appropriate, Mr. Chairman, if you're looking for comment.
Yeah, and I should, you know, make it clear to my colleagues and others, there are other motions will follow with regard to amending those findings of fact and conclusions of law. So, but let's adopt those as a starting point. Motion's been made. We'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries. I thought second, we did last week again approve the settlement stipulation that had been filed by the energy providers in the area along with the applicant. So I do think it's appropriate. And then just yesterday, I think we did have some filed amended findings of fact, conclusions of law. I think it's probably good to integrate those into that. So at this point, I would move the commission adopt those findings of fact and conclusions of law. Any comments? Hearing, go ahead.
This is still dealing with the same parties, Southeastern and HD Electric. It's just that we've added, obviously, what's in the filing, the underline. That's the only change that's taking place, right? And I didn't want to miss anything.
Well, and as you're speaking, it occurred to me that, you know, we haven't heard from the applicant as to whether or not they have any objection on those. That's probably reasonable. Let's pause and see if the applicant or any interveners have objection to what was filed yesterday.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brett Kennecke for the applicant.
Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nothing going on.
Daryl Spence here. That's fine.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Spence. Hold on just a second. I don't think we've got anybody muted. Okay, let's try it again, Mr. Kennecke.
Testing.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brett Kennecke for the applicant, Buffalo Ridge 2 and Iberdrola Renewables. We have no objection to the filing made by Ms. Rogers yesterday. In response to Commissioner Colbeck, it looked to me like it was adding the language from the stipulation into the current findings and conclusions.
Great. Thanks, Mr. Kennecke. Mr. Spence,
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's fine.
Okay, sounds good. Anyone else wish to comment on those? Okay, staff. Just look at staff. And, of course, the stipulation was staff indicated no problem with that last week, but we should see if you have any concerns integrating that into our findings of fact, conclusions of law.
No comment from staff.
Great, thanks very much. Unless there are other comments or questions, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Some commissioners have expressed some concern about decommissioning. We did hear additional evidence on that last week at the hearing. I did think one important piece of testimony was from Mr. Seck that the residual value of the leases, in his professional opinion, would be greater than the gap between salvage value of the steel and other commodity items and the decommissioning cost. And because those two items together add up to more than the decommissioning cost, I do think in this instance no additional bond or financial protection is probably necessary. So I would move that the commission put into place a findings of fact, a conclusion of law, a condition dealing with that 10-year forward look at that 90 days after the 10th year of operation that Iberdrola, or rather the applicant, will have to make a filing with regard to decommissioning, and at that point the commission can determine whether or not additional protection is necessary. Any comments on that?
Yeah, I just wanted to make one comment. I agree with you. The one thing I think that sold me on decommissioning right now, obviously the new investment out there is going to be tremendous, but also the fuel costs are not as susceptible to other things as coal or nuclear energy are. The fuel cost is always going to remain relatively at zero, so that's always going to hopefully have worth out there. But I think the decommissioning will be an issue in 10 years, and I think this is a good way to handle that.
Okay. Okay, other comments? Okay, with that, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johns votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thought the fourth item we should take up probably should be the concerns raised by interveners Carter and Spence, and you know specifically with regard to proposed turbine 91 and 92, 93, 94, 95. I think we probably should have a finding that turbine 91 is evidence on the record indicates it's 1,355 feet from their home, and that's 35.5% beyond the minimum residential setback that's required by the Brookings County ordinances. I think we probably need to have a finding that the sound studies that were done indicate that with the noisiest turbine proposed at the intervener's home, the sound would be 42 to 43 decibels, which is significantly lower than the 50 decibel limit that has been used by this commission in the past for generation projects and that is required by the Brookings County Ordinance. And, you know, I'll just add by way of narrative, the interveners raised some legitimate concerns, but there was not much in the way of evidence or witnesses that gave us a body of facts to be able to make the determinations we would need to make to order that turbine be moved. Not that I think this commission rejects out of hand their concerns, but you need to weigh their general concerns against the experience that we've had with the other generating units in South Dakota and the complaints that we have not received in years of those plants of all different types and designs running, as well as testimony from witnesses that they are unaware of turbines in this area or in Iberdrola's portfolio that have ever had to be moved or curtailed or even have been complained about by landowners in the affected area. So weighing those general concerns with very specific evidence, I think the commission needs to find that 1,000 feet and 50 decibels does provide adequate protection for landowners, and that no unique issues to Mr. Spence or Ms. Carter were ways to give them some sort of special setback treatment or some sort of carve-out only applicable to them. Any comments on those findings of fact?
Daryl Spence here. My wife couldn't join me today. I meant to be there in person, but I'm under the weather, so we're on the phone. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would have to agree with you that all the ordinances are met and the standards that have been used in the past. The more we've, as non-experts, have looked into things in regard to placement and siding, we find more and more questions as this relatively new technology, and I mean relative in terms of experience to the U.S. and South Dakota. It's relatively new, and there seems to be more and more coming up in regard to the standards that are used. So, yes, according to current standards and ordinances, the developer is certainly within those parameters. We don't contest that. We were looking for alternatives to lessen the possibility that a predicted effects might not be accurate. So we were looking at, and we did request, considering re-siting these turbines. So we understand from a technical aspect that the PUC is making a proper decision in that regard. Yes, in our point of view, not erecting Turbine 91 would certainly have an impact on us and our neighbors to the west and our neighbors to the south as far as the distance is concerned. I guess what I'll need to do is make this more of an opportunity to just express, knowing that the PUC staff have done their work in terms of technical aspects to this point, but to encourage for future development to see what the data brings forth as more and more of these developments occur. That's from a very general perspective. That won't help us in what we're asking. But I guess that's the main point I wanted to make today, and just encourage the Public Utility Commission and staff to I guess, keep an eye on what comes up in this regard. There have been some serious questions about how noise studies are conducted, not only the decibel levels, but also the low-frequency sounds. One term that comes up, I think, sounds a little funny, but the flicker effect should not be diminished in terms of what that could actually mean to certain in certain instances. And vibration, that'll remain to be seen from our point of view. So much is so dependent on the individual characteristics of the terrain, the property, time of day when studies were done, and all that kind of stuff. So I'll leave it to that. We would still like to request the developer, even though it's not going to be a requirement of the PUC, to consider not erecting Turbine 91.
Thanks, Mr. Spence. Commissioner, advisor comments on the pending motion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I appreciate very much Mr. Spence's comments just now. He graciously stepped away from, I guess you could say, a confrontational type of a situation, and he and Ms. Carter have presented all of their information in a very proper fashion, and we don't always see that type of a situation take place when a very emotional challenge for them, I'm sure, with their property there. And at the same time, I do agree that with the motion that you've made, primarily from a standpoint that the county has gone through the process of legislating, basically, and passing an ordinance which provides for setbacks. And I don't think it's proper for the Public Utilities Commission to basically step into a legislative position and second guess the judicious process, the legislative process that's taken place with the county. They obviously spent a significant amount of time examining it and adopting those regulations, and I think it's proper for us to support the motion that you've made. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other comments?
Terrell Spence here again.
Mr. Spence, let's go ahead and pause and give sure. Commissioner Kolbeck an opportunity to speak on the pending motion.
Certainly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to thank Mr. Spence and Ms. Carter also, but the questions that arose pertaining to sound I feel have been dealt with. 50 dB at 1,000 feet is roughly the equivalent of an office type setting. Mr. Spence and Ms. Carter are even farther than that, so that could be down to 40 dB, which is a living room without a TV. So I understand Mr. Spence's predicted effects and trying to see into the future of low-frequency problems, but this commission is not at the liberty of, say, writing a speeding ticket for going 25 miles an hour in a 35-mile-an-hour zone just because we think it should be. I don't think that the facts were presented. I think the facts that were presented actually addressed in the Brookings County Ordinance and the Dual County Ordinance is that this turbine is over 1,000 feet away, and it meets the ordinance. So I think that with all due respect to Mr. Spence and Ms. Carter, I think that the company has done due diligence, and I think that the commission has done their due diligence to make sure that all parties are acting within the law of the current facts and figures and information that we have. So I, too, would suggest that we support the chairman's motion.
Well, and a couple of quick comments, you know, hopefully to allay any continuing fears that Mr. Spencer and Ms. Carter have. You know, the commission does have some experience with noise, and in fact there is an AC-DC-AC intertie connector out west that was causing some problems to landowners, and the PUC did work for months with the owners of that facility to minimize the sound effect to landowners, and even after it was below certain levels, there were still efforts to, you know, make sure that landowners were not bothered any more than they need to. And certainly, our understanding of noise and sound has, as a commission, has increased dramatically since then. Commissioner Hansen did mention that, you know, it's consistent with Brookings County and dual county ordinances, but it's also consistent with past, you know, commission orders with generation units at 50 decibels. And of course, if you know, Mr. Spence, if there's ever a time when the applicant does not live up to the promises that have been made and the conditions that have been required, then, you know, that wind farm or a particular turbine, I mean, that can be shut down until they're in compliance with the commission order and with county ordinances. And you know, another comment, I mean, we do, I know this is new to you, and that's, my comments aren't going to make you feel any better, but it's not new to this state or not new to this region. I mean, there are thousands of megawatts of very similar machines that have, are near thousands of residences, and we just don't have evidence that there have been complaints from any of those landowners about sound. Other commissioner or advisor comments? With Mr. Spence, normally we wouldn't give an intervener another opportunity to speak, but you wanted to go ahead. If there are other comments, we're happy to hear them from you.
Oh, I just wanted to point out that I agree with you that the Brookings County certainly done their due diligence in the past. At one as I understand it, at one time the setback was 500 feet was the standard in Brookings County. And so I just want to acknowledge, yes, we certainly understand that the county within what they have observed has, you know, taken what they feel to be appropriate action in terms of setting those ordinances.
Great. Thanks very much.
If I'm misunderstanding about that, the question, I think, has to do with other factors we've seen. But that's not a point of issue in this dialogue at this point.
With that, the commission will proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. My last thought would be that we also instruct commission counsel to make necessary adjustments to the findings of fact and conclusions of law that we have adopted to the extent that those are not consistent with what we heard in the record or what we have in the record. Allow him to make those changes. And I wouldn't think it'd be very long before we get an order out the door, but Ms. Smith, I think giving you a little bit of latitude probably is helpful in making sure we get something right. And so with that, I'll combine with that a motion to approve the permit to construct the Buffalo Ridge 2 wind generation project in accordance with the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and terms and conditions that have been put on the project by the commission. Any discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Anson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. And thank you to the applicant and the interveners and staff for all their hard work on this proceeding. With that, we'll proceed to miscellaneous item number one, which is the matter of the petition by staff to terminate the ongoing information requirement that was set forth by the Commission in 1989 in docket F-3661. And that is the question for the Commission today. At this time, we'll turn toward Mr. Jacobson and Ms. Kramer for their comments.
Thank you, Chairman. This is Dave Jacobson again. Yes, we were contacted by Mid-American Energy some time back, and they actually requested that we terminate this reporting requirement. They were the last one to comply with this order, and we would compliment them for that, for their continued compliance. And we would just ask that the Commission grant the petition to terminate the requirements in F-3661.
Any affected utility wish to comment on this?
This is Susan Stewart from Mid-American.
Yeah, Ms. Stewart, go ahead.
We did bring this to, as Mr. Dave Jacobson said, we did bring this to his attention that we'd been filing this report. We never saw anything happen with it. We applaud both the staff and the commission for getting rid of a regulatory requirement like this when they determined that it's not necessary, and we would urge the commission to grant the staff petition.
There is something a little ironic about a filing estimating the cost of regulation to be continued on long after perhaps it has a useful purpose. Other questions? Or rather, other comments? Is that any commissioner questions?
No. Maybe just one more, just one comment that I think the cost is not justified for the gain in this docket filing. I'll motion that the commission grant the petition to terminate the ongoing information requirement in docket F-3661.
Motion has been made. Other discussion on the motion? Commissioner Hansen?
Aye.
Commissioner Colbeck?
Aye.
Commissioner Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. And a gold star to Mid-American for continuing the filing long after others had given up the fight. Natural gas item number one is in the matter of filing by MDU for approval of its conservation programs and conservation tracking adjustment. The question before the commission today is, shall it approve the proposed tariff sheets and extend the currently effective conservation program as well as augment it and add to it? We'll turn toward Montana Dakota for their comments at this time.
Thank you, Chairman, Commissioners. The filing before you consists of three items: a request to remove the experimental qualifier to Montana Dakota's gas conservation program, secondly, approval of a new portfolio of gas conservation programs, and thirdly, approval of a tracking adjustment to be effective May 1 under our current tariff, which represents our annual true-up. Montana Dakota, as I said, is requesting approval of its tracking adjustment to be effective May 1, 2009, and extension of the current programs that we offer today. We're also asking that the docket remain open to allow sufficient time for the company and staff to work through the new portfolio of programs that we provided in our March 2, 2009 filing. And I'll just turn now to the conservation tracking adjustment change that we're requesting to be effective May 1. The updated adjustment is 0.5 cents per DK for the Black Hills system and 0.4 cents per DK for the East River system. And this includes the recovery of any undercollected expenditures from last year. Montana Dakota, as you know, implemented a portfolio of natural gas conservation programs back in 2006 under the experimental tariff approved by the commission. Rebates are awarded upon verification of participation to assist customers in employing cost-effective measures. Today, our authorized programs consist of rebates for high-efficiency natural gas furnaces, programmable thermostats, and conservation kits. As of February 28, 2009, there were 41 furnace rebates and 86 programmable thermostat rebates awarded to customers in South Dakota, and we provided, made available approximately 1,000 of the conservation kits. The programs are promoted with bill inserts, postings on our Energy Center web pages, and through a link to, from the Commission's website. In addition, Montana Dakota participated with South Dakota PUC staff, Black Hills Power, and several other vendors in sponsoring an Energy Awareness Day in Rapid City in October. So we ask for your approval of the tracking adjustment today. Allow us to continue to offer our current portfolio of programs until we can get back before the Commission on the new portfolio of programs that we suggested in our March 2nd filing. Thank you, and I'm available for questions.
Staff, comments.
Thank you, Chairman. As the company stated, this would extend the current conservation program, and we would submit until September 30th, 2009. And we would request that you approve the new updated conservation tracking adjustment recovery surcharges with an effective date of May 1st, 2009.
Okay. Questions? For Ms. Aberle, I mean, you described a little bit the, you know, what we've seen as far as participation. Are there surprises in here? I mean, things that are different from what you expected?
Chairman, the programs have been picking up some speed. We see some improvements in participation. Certainly, participation was less than we originally estimated, but we really, you know, didn't have a basis, you know, in terms of how customers would participate in our original filing. In the portfolio that we have proposed for an ongoing basis, we've adjusted those participation rates, and the programs all are still cost show a cost benefit to all customers.
And how did, I mean, if participation was less than you expected, do you have any idea how it compares to the participation in your other jurisdictions at the time the programs were launched? I'm just trying to figure out if we're lower than we thought, what's the reason for that? I mean, are we just naturally stubborn people, or do we have a marketing gap or an education gap, or... You know, if we're going to spend money on these programs, we want to make sure they're effective, and I know obviously Mid-American does too. Your thoughts?
Chairman, in looking at the other jurisdictions where we offer this, we have one in particular where we see a higher participation than the others. We believe that is really a buy-in from the dealers, and so that's really going to be our focus in the next year is to, while we work with the dealers and providing them information, is to get those providers on board with the programs available in addition to the customers so that when they're working with customers, they are aware of what's available and can hopefully then move that customer, help us to move that customer into a higher efficient unit.
Okay, and you described the, you know, the rate changes for each of the two jurisdictions in South Dakota or areas in South Dakota. I didn't see any estimate of monthly impact. It may be in there. It just didn't jump out at me.
It's the total adjustment is at 0.5 cents.
Yeah, I saw that. But as far as once you push that through,
on an annual basis, it's about 50 cents a customer. So it's a very you know, a small contribution from all customers in support of these programs.
Okay. Thanks. Other questions?
Oh.
I just had the one question. It's my understanding that all the impact tests came back positive. Is that correct?
Commissioner, that is correct.
Okay. And I think Commissioner Hansen, the ratepayer impact and the visibility of it were my other two questions, but I, Commissioner Johnson had addressed those. Thank you, Tammy.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'm just, Ms. Aberle, I'm just curious on your Home Energy Suite website. How long has that been up and running, and how successful has it been?
Commissioner, if you're referring to the Apogee Home Energy website that we refer to in our portfolio, that is a site that we're developing yet,
okay,
and is not included in this cost recovery.
All right.
At this point.
Thank you very much. I misunderstood, and I appreciate that. I'll look forward to seeing that up and running and see what the success is. And if there's, do you know if there will be any way to measure participation from different states or anything of that nature?
Well, I know that in some of the review and that we've done of the site, I mean, there's ways to monitor who is. Utilizing the site. I'm not sure if we can differentiate by location, but we will be monitoring and be able to see who is using that for, and it really is a very robust system in terms of allowing customers to estimate energy usage based on different appliances, and it is a as stated, takes into account the weather in each of those areas. So it may be if they're moved to a South Dakota page that we would be able to mark that then and track that participation that way.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
A couple of comments, give you an opportunity to respond, Ms. Aberle. You know, when you're in Exhibit B, your notice to customers, I mean, I think technically it meets all the requirements. Sometimes I just sort of wonder when we make these, you know, when we communicate with customers, if it wouldn't be more beneficial for them to understand why the rates are being revised, not even necessarily for this particular exhibit, but in the future. Do you think there's any value in adding a half a sentence that the reason it's being revised is to, you know, keep these kind of, you know, efficiency programs going? People may see a closer link to cost and benefit if they know what it's for.
Yes, that is an excellent comment, Chairman, and we'll take a look at how we've explained the filing on those exhibits.
Okay, thanks. And then I was, you know, I think some we get very concerned about free riders, and we ask a lot of questions about that generally with these efficiency filings. I was a little surprised, pleasantly surprised, that when you look at the household income level of the people who, you know, took the demand side management survey, I mean, 43% of the households in 08 made $50,000 a year or less, and in 07 it was 47%. So, you know, it's not the fat cats that are just taking advantage of these rebates. It's people with relatively modest means. Am I reading those results right?
That is correct.
Okay, and is that consistent with what you're seeing in other jurisdictions?
Well, we don't actually survey our customers in the other jurisdictions, so I don't have the income data available for those that we do in South Dakota.
Okay. Other questions?
Commissioner, if I could.
Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Rislov.
Tammy, this is Greg Rislov. I have a couple questions. I was somewhat struck by the fact that all the impact tests you measured or the tests there were four, I think we're positive and for each and every program. Is that correct?
In the portfolio, new portfolio, excuse me, that we proposed, yes, they were.
I was also surprised that the ratepayer impact test at times seemed to, well, be higher than at least two other tests. To what extent can I attribute this difference to the discount rates being used for these various tests?
I cannot answer that question.
Okay. Well, I'll maybe try to expand a bit, but those discount rates varied relatively widely, I thought, for those different tests. And I'm not saying there wasn't justification for it, but I would be curious in future filings if perhaps there was a bit more backup supply to the discount rates going to be used to determine the cost savings for the various customers. I think that's somewhat important. I won't go into the numbers now, but I believe they were on the scale of 50% in some cases. I have another question, too. Do you have a maximum on the number of rebates you intend to offer within each area, or is it just open-ended?
We have not established a maximum.
So right now there's no thought that it's going to become, say move from 50 cents up to $50 a year. You know, that would be a hopeful thought, I suppose.
And yes, that is part of the hope. And we do monitor the programs. And so if we were approaching something that was exceeding our what we had estimated or what we, you know, I guess in terms of what we had provided to the commission as part of support of the new programs, we would certainly try to take a look at that and make a change if necessary, you know, in the middle interim period before we get to the tracking adjustment.
A midstream heads up, if necessary anyway, perhaps. That I would think that would be a good idea. And one final question, how does this program in South Dakota, if approved, as we see in front of us, how does that compare to what you're doing in the other states you serve?
The programs that we have proposed for our on a go-forward basis is a portfolio we are just putting forth in the other states that we provide service. And just to be clear, we will be continuing to work with staff on this portfolio of programs, and that is was the reference to by the end of September. So with regard to discount rates, your original question, first question, we can provide additional information on those programs at this time. So for the programs, the new portfolio, it's something we're moving forward with all of the states. South Dakota is the first one that we've filed. In regard to the programs that are reflected in the cost recovery mechanism, those programs are the same in three of the states that we offer conservation programs.
Thank you.
Other questions? Mr. Jacobson, so I can be sure about your recommendation, you wanted the commission to extend the proposed program offerings to September 1st?
September 30th.
September 30th.
Okay. 2009.
Good, thanks. And an effective date of the tariff changes of May 1st.
That's correct.
Okay. Okay. Any action? I would go ahead. I would move that the commission approve the tariff changes effective May 1st. Remove the experimental label for this program. Extend the program offerings until September 30th with an expanded portfolio. And that's it. Any questions on any comments on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson.
Aye.
Colbeck.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
With that, we'll proceed to natural gas item number 2. It is in the matter of the filing by MidAmerican for approval of tariff revisions. MidAmerican, any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Melanie Acord. To give you a little perspective, historically, in 2004, MidAmerican received approval from the Commission to implement a monthly metered transportation gas pilot project tariff. The pilot program allows schools and governmental entities to take advantage of gas transportation without the need to install and pay for daily metering. Since approval, MidAmerican has gained experience related to monthly meter transportation and is proposing to make the program permanent and to expand availability to all small-volume, non-residential customers. While the permanent program is primarily the same as the pilot program, MidAmerican is proposing some revisions based on experience gained over the past few years. These changes have been discussed with interested suppliers or pool operators in a meeting held on April 7th. There were no objections or concerns raised at that meeting or since that meeting. The sole pool operator with customers in South Dakota indicated intent to transition all current customers to the permanent program. MidAmerican is seeking an effective date of April 21st to allow the transition of current pilot program customers beginning May 1, with all customers transitioned to the permanent program by June. If there are any questions, I have a team of Tammy Christman and Tom Gazelle available for questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Acord. Staff, comments?
Thank you, Chairman. This is Dave Jacobson. As the company stated, this makes their pilot program for the monthly meter transportation service available on a permanent basis. The company has stated that this will allow greater confidence in knowing that the program will be available in the future and may enhance participation by customers. Currently, there are 96 customers that they are trying to, that they will move over to the permanent service. Just for an idea, there are 233 transportation customers altogether on MidAmerican system at this time. One item we would note is that there are five different fees that the company has proposed to have in place in the permanent program. And they asked for an annual reconciliation of those fees. The fees are swing service, weekend service, administrative scheduling, administration scheduling, and switching. And what we would recommend is that the swing service and weekend service, instead of an annual reconciliation, because those are pipeline cost based and related to the PGA items, that those items, instead of an annual reconciliation, be updated at the time of PGA changes so that they can just flow through on a constant basis. That keeps them in compliance with our purchase gas adjustment statute. The other administrative scheduling and switching fees, we would recommend that they not be updated on an annual basis, that they just remain in effect as filed and supported by the work papers included in the filing until and only be considered for change at the time of a general rate increase. With that understanding and with that condition, we would recommend approval of the filing.
Thanks, Mr. Jacobson. Let's walk through each of those fees listed on page 4, make sure we understand your recommendation. So there are three options, that which has been recommended by MidAmerican or an annual adjustment, adding it essentially to the PGA, and remind us for MidAmerican the timeline for the adjustment of their PGA over the during the course of a year. And then the third option is to not make any adjustment until the next filed rate case. So first let's start with the PGA timeline, kind of talk us through how that's handled for MidAmerican, and then let's go through each of the five fees and remind us of your recommendation.
Okay. Yes, see, if you look on page 4 of the filing, they are listed there. The administrative fee, that is not PGA related, and we would recommend that that fee be approved on a continuing basis as filed with no annual reconciliation. Swing service fee is pipeline fee related, and we would recommend that that follow changes in the PGA. Scheduling fee is not PGA related, and recommend that that just remain in effect until the next general rate increase. Weekend service is pipeline fee related, and we would recommend that that be do follow PGA changes as filed in the future. And the switching fee is not PGA related, and we recommend that that charge stay in place until a review of a general rate review.
And Each of our three natural gas providers handle the PGA adjustments a little bit different, if memory serves. What is the adjustment timeline for Mid-American?
It's monthly.
Okay, monthly. Month to month or any sort of a average? Is it changed monthly with a trailing three-month average, or is it just every month adjusted based on last month's data?
Well, it's a combination of historical data is reviewed, but it's also a combination. And purchase gas adjustments are based on also on forward-looking estimates of gas prices, and so that would be part of that. But mostly these relate to pipeline fees as opposed to commodity costs. So.
Oh, sure. Great, thanks. Other questions? Mid-American, comments on staff's recommendations.
Mid-American concurs with staff's recommendations.
Okay, thanks very much. With that, any commissioner comments or action?
I'll motion in NG09-002 that the commission approve the tariff revisions. I've got them written down, but I'll save it per staff's recommendations.
And I'll read them off, make sure at least three of us are on the same page, and that is the administrative fee, the scheduling fee, and the switched fee not have monthly reconciliation but be in effect until the next general rate case, and that the switching service fee and the weekend service rider change monthly with the PGA adjustment.
Correct.
That's two A's, PGA adjustment, I said. It's all right. Any comments on the pending motion? I do have a question, Mr. Jacobson. Ms. Acord mentioned a timeline and effective date of today, maybe, did she say, to allow the transition to begin on May 1st and to be completed by June 1st? Is that right?
That is what they requested, yes, April 1st effective date.
Oh, April 1st.
April 21st.
April 21st.
Yes.
Does an approval in less than 30 days' notice of those tariff changes need special mention in our motion?
Mr. Chairman, this is Melanie Acord. We did file this with 30 days notice.
Oh, that's right. You did. Sure. Thanks very much. All right. Mr. Jacobs, any concern with an effective date of today?
No.
Okay, great. We do have a pending motion. Commissioner Colbeck, I'm going to presume you want an effective date of today as requested.
Yes, with an effective date of April 21st.
Perfect. Other comments? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we'll proceed to telecom item number one, TC07-107. This deals with the ongoing reduced rates docket. The question for the commission today is, shall it grant staff's request to withdraw its previously filed motion and, in addition, to close the docket? Ms. Semler, comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the recent resolution and commission approval of all individually filed complaints, staff simply withdraws its previous motion. Revolved around a concern staff had with reduced rates compliance with a commission order. I withdraw that motion and simply ask the commission dismiss this docket today, or close this docket, excuse me.
Anyone from reduced rates wish to comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Meredith Moore appearing on behalf of reduced rates. I just wanted to thank commission staff and the commission for working with us in this particular docket and appreciate the patience throughout. We would simply ask that the commission dismiss or allow Ms. Semler on behalf of staff to withdraw the previously filed motion and also to close the docket. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Moore. Questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I have a question of staff. Has reduced rates settled all of the formal complaints according to the consent order?
Yes, they have.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Does this end it? I mean, this is the last of our dealings with reduced rates for any fines or penalties?
You are correct. All of the individually filed formal complaints have been dismissed. This is staff's show cause, where we tried to include all of the complaints, whether formal or informal, that have been brought to our attention, and this will close. And our dealings with reduced rates, and we have not had any additional complaints. So by all accounts, Deb, Greg, and I do believe that they've changed their internal policies.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any additional questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
I move that in TC07-107 that the Commission grant staff's request to withdraw its previously filed motion and close the docket.
Motion has been made. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Kobach?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. We're putting telecom item number 2 at the end. We'll proceed to telecom item number 3, which is TC08-131. This deals with the request VCI company has made for relinquishment of its ETC designation. At this time, if anyone from VCI is on the phone or present, we would hear from them. Hearing none, staff comments.
Thank you. Tim Binder for staff. VCI currently has no South Dakota customers. They're not in possession of any deposits or prepayments. Staff does recommend relinquishing the ETC status for VCI company.
Questions?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Binder, you said that we're sure they have no customers in South Dakota?
Sure might be a strong word for me, but from all indications, they did indicate to us several months ago that they have no customers in South Dakota. We've received absolutely no complaints from any customers or any notification from anyone. I checked with Consumer Affairs. I'm fairly confident that they have no customers currently and that they didn't have customers at the time of this filing.
Okay. And you said no complaints?
Yeah, no complaints at all.
Did they do any notification to any state agencies, or was there any requirements for that?
There are requirements for notification. The company indicated that at the time they filed for this, they had no customers, so they felt they didn't need to notify any customers, or they had no customers to notify for this, for the relinquishment of ETC status.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there questions? Hearing none, any comments or action? I would approve the commission approve VCI company's relinquishment of its ETC designation. Any comments on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Telecom item number 4 deals with the filing by Midstate for extension of exemption from developing company-specific cost-based access rates. First off, the first question is, shall the commission grant late-filed intervention to Mid-Continent? We'll hear first from Mid-Continent.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. My name is Dave Gertis. I'm a lawyer from Pierre, and I represent Mid-Continent Communications in this docket. Mid-Continent Communications filed a petition to intervene earlier in this docket and seeks to intervene for the reasons stated in the petition. I do know that as of late yesterday afternoon, I received a written objection from Midstate to this request for intervention by Mid-Continent. And so I'll just go ahead and indicate to the commission that we believe that this intervention petition is well taken. Granting intervention will not unduly prejudice any rights. This is a late-filed intervention. We submit that it will not unduly prejudice any rights. As a matter of fact, when it was filed on April 7th, there was absolutely nothing on the website as far as any activity that was going on in the docket. Secondly, there's a question raised as to whether or not Mid-Continent has standing to intervene, and I would submit that the fact that both companies compete in the Chamberlain Exchange, and the fact that Mid-Continent would be subject to a greater switched access rate than would otherwise be present if the higher rate were terminated, as would happen if the renewal were not permitted, stands as a reason that the Mid-Continent does in fact have a business interest in this docket and is certainly is interested in the outcome of the docket. As we mentioned in our intervention petition, Mid-Continent is held to the Quest rate in terms of its switched access charges, which is 6.042 cents. On the other hand, Mid-State has a much larger, almost twice as much switched access rate, which is 11.5 cents. Mid-Continent is interested in robust communication in and fair communication in the exchanges in the United States, or excuse me, in the state of South Dakota. As you know, Mid-Continent is a CLEC and is does business in a number of exchanges in the state, including I think virtually all of the Quest exchanges and a number of rural exchanges. We also believe that staff has previously said that for one CLEC to have a higher switched access rate than other competing CLECs gives that CLEC a huge competitive advantage against other CLECs in the same docket, in the same exchange. And this, of course, is another reason why Mid-Continent has a business interest in becoming a part of this docket and why Mid-Continent should be heard and that there should be a hearing on the question of whether or not this joint motion to settle joint motion and stipulation to settle the docket between staff and Mid-State should be approved. This was something that was entered into subsequent to Mid-Continent's petition being filed. Certainly the parties can't say that they didn't know that Mid-Continent had an interest in filing because the intervention petition was filed and on file at least a week before the settlement stipulation was filed. For all those reasons, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, we would submit that Mid-Continent's application to intervene should be approved. And I'll stand by for any questions.
Thanks. Mid-States.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Darla Pullman Rogers, and I represent Mid-State Telecom in this docket. As Mr. Gerdes indicated, we did file written objections to the motion, the late filed petition to intervene that was filed by Mid-Continent. We believe, first of all, that Mid-Continent has failed to meet the intervention standards for a timely filed intervention petition. Midco is not an interested party by statute. In fact, they pointed to no statute that would give them a party status or interest in this particular docket. And second of all, Mid-State is not bound and affected either favorably or adversely with respect to an interest peculiar to petitioner. Midco is not bound because, actually, contrary to what Mr. Gerdes says, Mid-State does not compete against Mid-Continent in the Chamberlain Exchange. Midco has no facilities in Chamberlain. Mid-State, in fact, is a cable TV provider in Chamberlain. Quest is the LEC, the local exchange carrier, and Mid-State is the other CLEC, the other competing carrier in that area. Mid-Continent does not have facilities in Chamberlain, is not competing against Mid-State or Quest in that area. So this docket, we would submit, is not the appropriate forum for Mid-Continent to raise its policy arguments concerning CLEC access rates. And I would tell you that Mid-State does not necessarily disagree with some of Mid-Continent's policy statements. However, all of these points and issues can be raised in the rulemaking docket, which is currently pending before this commission. Secondly, we would submit that, in fact, this was not a timely filed intervention petition. And in the case where a petition is late filed, we believe the bar is raised with regard to what the petitioner has to establish. The standard now becomes whether any party is unduly prejudiced if the late filed intervention is granted. Mid-State would, in this case, be unduly prejudiced if this motion is granted. And that is because of the negotiated stipulation that Mid-State has entered into with staff. While Mid-Continent has pointed out the timing in this case, and I agree with his statement that the petition to intervene was filed right before or just before the settlement stipulation was filed. Nonetheless, we were negotiating that settlement stipulation prior to the time that it was actually filed. There were a few things that we needed to work out with staff, you know, the timing, the timelines in there and things like that. And we were working on those. It just didn't get filed before the petition. But I don't believe that that changes what should transpire in this case. Mid-State would be unduly prejudiced if you grant this late filed intervention. So I don't believe the petitioner has met the rules that are in place for granting late filed intervention, and I would ask that you deny the petition to intervene. And then subsequently, if you wish to talk about the stipulation, we'd be happy to do that as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Rogers, for Mid-State. Staff.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer for staff. Staff would also recommend denying the intervention. It was late filed, and MIDCO has given no legal reason for that late filing. In fact, offered no reason whatsoever. It was on our fax filing. They had plenty of time to file. It's the usual intervention deadline. There was nothing shortened about it. In fact, the people who are directly affected, the IXCs, you know, have not intervened in this matter. As Ms. Rogers pointed out, they are merely asking for status quo here until the rules are out so they can take a look at those and determine what it is they want to do. I don't believe MIDCO has an interest peculiar to the petitioner as distinguished from an interest common to the public. As I stated, even the IXCs did not file for intervention. MIDCO in its docket, which is where I think a lot of these arguments can be made or in the rulemaking. They certainly should not be made here. But one of the major differences, MIDCO requested an increase. And here again, Mid-State is just merely asking that things remain as they are until the rules are complete. And that's what our stipulation says. I do believe the parties would be prejudiced by allowing their intervention. I'm not clear either what the intervention would do. Do we go to hearing to determine if a cost study should be filed? Well, I think Mid-State's pretty clear there, or they can speak for themselves, but they probably will file a cost study once they know what the rules are. But it would be silly now to file a cost study based on non-existent or rules maybe that don't apply to them. Or would we have a hearing to determine what their rate should be? Well, again, you would need a cost study for that. I don't understand what MIDCO can bring to the table here. I don't believe they can bring anything to the table. And finally, I agree with Ms. Rogers that MIDCO does not compete in the Chamberlain Exchange. Staff specifically asked in a data request about a year ago, where do they serve? And they listed 39 exchanges. Excuse me. And then again at the hearing, staff asked Mr. Simmons, what are the exchanges you serve? And they serve a total of 39, and they're listed alphabetically, but they go Big Stone City, Box Elder, Canton, Central City, and then it goes into the D's, Deadwood, then Ellsworth. They, by their own testimony, do not serve in Chamberlain, so I'm not sure what standing they have here. But that would be staff's comments.
Thanks. Mr. Curtis?
If I may have a short rebuttal, Mr. Chairman. First of all, it may have been an oversight if Chamberlain was left out of that list, but Mid-Continent does have customers in Chamberlain. And if Mid-Continent has, and I would agree with both Ms. Kramer and Ms. Rogers that we would have a very weak case indeed if we didn't have customers in Chamberlain, but we do. Mid-Continent does have customers in Chamberlain. And so for that reason, I believe that Mid-Continent has standing. Certainly it cannot be said that Mid-Continent has no interest in the outcome of this at all, if in fact Mid-Continent is potentially prejudiced by the maintenance or the continued maintenance of this higher switched access rate. By its own comments in Mid-Continent's cost docket earlier, staff has said that a CLEC is a disadvantage if another CLEC gets a higher rate. I mean, you can't take that away. It's in their brief. As far as this being a late filed intervention, we believe that it does in fact meet the standards for intervention under the late filed rules, because there had been nothing occurring before the petition to intervene was filed. The fact that they agreed upon a stipulation to settle this docket after Mid-Continent had intervened does not permit them to use that fact against Mid-Continent's status at the time it filed its petition to intervene. At that time, there was nothing going on. They did not have an agreement. And I would submit, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, that Mid-Continent is entitled to intervention and to be heard. We have a situation here where they say they're maintaining the status quo. There's no status quo. The authorization to charge that rate terminated. And something affirmative had to happen before it got started back up. And, of course, that's what this stipulation is for, that they have entered into, is to start that rate back up. But it terminated. So there's no status quo here. We're back in limbo. We would submit that there's no undue prejudice whatsoever. If the parties were negotiating, that's fine. But they hadn't agreed upon anything at the time Mid-Continent made its filing. And so for those reasons, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, we would submit that the petition to intervene is well taken. I would make just one last comment, and that is I believe staff has said this on other occasions before this commission, and I'll say it again, that this commission has a history of using a very liberal rule when it comes to whether or not to award or to grant intervention petitions, and that the emphasis this commission has always had is to let someone in if they have some interest in a docket, and that that's where the bias lies. And we would submit that this is clearly a case where intervention should be permitted. Thank you very much.
Questions? Mr. Curtis, can you get, I mean, we've heard that Mid-Continent doesn't have facilities in Chamberlain, isn't a competitor there, and you're indicating that there are customers. Can you help us understand what might be the...
Well, the customers, excuse me.
Go ahead.
The customers, I am given to understand that the customers in Chamberlain are customers, but they're using resold services. And that Chamberlain is not one of those which is an ETC designated area, but Mid-Continent is doing business there. And, we do have customers, that we're servicing, reselling, I believe it's Quest Services, reselling Quest Services.
Okay, so then I would just pause and ask if any of the other parties would submit to the commission that those facts are in question.
Well, I did check their website yesterday, and they don't list Chamberlain on their website either. And as I say, their testimony, given a couple opportunities to, I mean, they probably may very well, but not by their own sworn testimony. They do not.
Now, Mr. Chairman, there's no sworn testimony here. This is not an evidentiary hearing. If the commission wants to have an evidentiary hearing on the subject, we'll be more than happy to bring the evidence before the commission.
And I was speaking of TC-07117, where Mr. Simmons testified as to what the exchanges where they provide service, and Chamberlain is not listed. And so that's what I'm referring to. And just to clear up an earlier misstatement by Mr. Gerdes, actually staff and Midstate have been working on this settlement long before his late filed intervention. And so that was actually occurring in probably January, February.
Well.
Okay. Other questions?
Hi.
Yes, go ahead, Ms. Weist.
Even if Mid-Continent wasn't actually providing, you know, local exchange services in Chamberlain, as an IXC, it still would be terminating and thus paying switched access rates to Mid-State.
That's true. Yeah, excuse me. That's true.
You'd be in the same position as any other IXC in the state.
That's true. And so we would have an interest based on that we would be terminating traffic in Chamberlain. Thank you.
Ms. Kramer.
Yes, but I would point out his intervention specifically referred to being a CLEC.
Ms. Weist, is that legal distinction important?
I was trying to find the intervention as to what they actually said. I know they said that they compete with, I believe they say they compete with Midstate in Chamberlain.
Yes.
My point is that to the extent that an IXC would come before the commission and intervene in a case involving switched access, we routinely grant those types of interventions.
And I'm just asking if there is a peculiar interest that a party has, but they don't raise it in their petition. I mean, I'm just curious whether or not that omission is important.
I think that the petition itself would be broad enough to encompass it.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman, it was very interesting listening to the last discussion, since in filing by Mid-Continent said that the two companies compete in Chamberlain Exchange, and in the other information that was filed, states by Mid-States, states that they do not compete, and I thought we might get into a definition of what is compete. You could have two teams on the basketball floor, but if one of them's not scoring points, they're not competing. But they're what just exactly is our definition of competition here?
Commissioner Hansen,
you don't have to.
Commissioner Hansen. I wasn't much of a basketball player, so I would have been one of those that wasn't competing back when I was of that age and in participating. But I would submit that if companies are both in the same exchange, they are, in fact, competing in the economic sense of the word competition.
I'm going to assume, and I'd be interested in hearing from Ms. Rogers on this, as to I'm going to assume that they were not aware that you're apparently reselling through, you say, Result Services?
Through Quest.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to assume that Midstate was just not aware of that, and that's why they're saying that you're not competing. And I'll look to Ms. Rogers to tell me whether or not she believes that there is competition at this juncture.
Thank you. I believe what I stated in my comments is that Mid-Continent has no facilities in Chamberlain, so they're not a cable TV provider. Quest, as I said, is a local exchange carrier. Mid-State is CLEC-ing there. It is my understanding in talking to people that work in Chamberlain from Mid-State that there is not competition in the sense that Mid-Continent is out there competing for customers as would be Mid-State and Quest. Now, if they have customers in that area, it would be my understanding that they may have some carryover long-distance customers pursuant to a resale agreement that they would have had with Quest, and that was back when a customer could choose, you know, or pick a particular long-distance carrier. So if they have customers there, I believe that those would be the type of customers. I don't consider that to be the same as the statement made in the petition that they're in competition, because I don't believe that to be the actual state of affairs down there as far as competing for local customers.
You heard the testimony. They're selling services. Are they not competing then if they're selling services?
I believe that they have some customers there, and again, this is just my understanding based on, you know, past arrangements that they had with Quest, and I believe that those are long-distance customers, to my knowledge. So that would be I'm not sure that I consider that competition in the sense that, you know, they are probably held over customers from prior arrangements.
Okay. In one of your arguments, you stated that the rulemaking process is, on page 4, stated that the rulemaking process is currently pending. Any arguments that Mid-Continent has with regard to the Commission's treatment of CLECs and other similarly situated carriers are best addressed in the docket RMO5-002, simply because they have that ability to raise the objections in that docket. Does that preclude them from having the opportunity to raise the objections here?
I believe, Commissioner Hansen, that the genesis or the core of Mid-Continent's comments are that they believe that there should be a keen interest in robust competition, and that all CLEC rates should be determined by the same methodology. That's what I understand their real interest is, and I believe those types of policy arguments certainly can be raised in other areas. They have other dockets that are open now, and also this rulemaking docket. I would also note, and so my point is, does that necessarily preclude intervention in this docket? My point is that they would not be prejudiced if their intervention petition is not allowed here, because they have other avenues in which to raise their issues. And on the flip side, I believe Mid-State would be prejudiced just because of the status of this particular docket. I would also point out to you that it appears to me that Mid-Continent has tended to not attach a lot of importance to that rulemaking docket by saying that it's been open since 2005 and that there hasn't been any action. And I guess I would disagree with that in the sense that it's only been in the last few months that rulemaking docket was actually converted to a CLEC docket, as this commission also recognized the need to have a particular methodology in place. And this commission also put a time restriction on when we were supposed to see some type of a template or proposed rule in that case, so the parties will know, you know, what the rules are out there. Our, you know, Mid-State's whole intention in filing its original application to extend the deadline was, as Ms. Kramer said, to preserve the status quo. And we're not here saying that we're not going to file a cost study once we know what the rules are. We're just trying to avoid having to do basically what Mid-Continent did in one of their dockets, and that is go to the time and expense of filing a study, on rules that have not been approved by this commission and then not having it accepted, and then we're in limbo with regard to the rates. And so that was our whole purpose, and we're not here saying we want this to go on in perpetuity. We're saying for this limited amount of time, we want the ability to know what the rules are, and then we're going to step up to the plate and follow them.
So I understand the way in which you were the phraseology that you used when you were speaking about whether or not it would preclude them from participation. I guess I'm having a challenge threading them together, but let me ask you another question on that. In Mid-Continent's petition to intervene, they state that Mid-State at a particular price will have a huge competitive advantage over Mid-Continent and any other CLEC. Would you disagree with that?
Yes, sir.
You would not see a competitive advantage at the current pricing?
Commissioner Hansen, no, I do not see a huge competitive advantage. I don't see a competitive advantage at all because, again, my understanding of their status in the Chamberlain area is they are not competing for customers as is Midstate and Quest. That's not their role there. Any customers that they have are customers that in the past had been picked to them, and I don't believe that that is the issue at all that Mr. Gerdes was raising in his petition.
Thank you. In your petition to objection to the petition to intervene, you talk about the detriment to the public interest. Would it not be detrimental to the public interest if we prohibited the competition from taking place?
Commissioner,
excuse me for all the double negatives there, but
I do not, Commissioner Hansen, I do not see that if you deny Mid-Continent's petition to intervene in this docket that you would be in any way impeding or prohibiting competition in the Chamberlain area. I think the status quo, there's been competition there all along. That competition is between Quest and Midstate, and that's going to continue. And that status quo is going to go on. And then if and when you develop new rules, then we will abide by those rules.
Thank you. I have one last question, if I may, Mr. Chairman. And this is of Mr. Gerdes. I'm just curious on your statement in your petition to intervene that, where you do state that Mid-State will have a huge competitive advantage over Mid-Continent and the other CLEC. You heard Ms. Rogers' oral rebuttal to your statement there. Do you have any position?
Well, I guess the first response I would have, Mr. Commissioner, is that's exactly what staff said in TCO 7117, which was Mid-Continent's docket for switched access rates. And the staff has said that if you have an imbalance, or said this in their petition, if you had this imbalance and you had one CLEC that was able to charge a much higher switched access rate than the other, that CLEC would have a huge advantage. So I'm just applying that same philosophy to this docket under what I see as the same circumstances. And so that's where that came from. If I may clarify, you know, we're doing a lot of talking here about facts, and this, of course, is not a fact-finding issue. I take issue with Ms. Rogers because Mid-Continent does provide local service in the resold local service in the Chamberlain exchange. Now, the fact that they have not claimed ETC status there is why they were left off their advertising. But nonetheless, and it's for you to decide whether that's competition or not. In my book, if you've got two telecommunications companies doing business in the same exchange, I would submit that that's competition. Lastly, if I may, Ms. Rogers says that the rulemaking docket is Mid-Continent's answer. This docket, the one we're trying to get into, is the answer, because this is where the business is being done. This is one competitor against another, and I submit that Mid-Continent's entitled to be there and to object to the settlement that was entered while Mid-Continent's petition to intervene was pending, but before there was an opportunity to have a hearing. And I would submit that Mid-Continent was entitled to be at the table when those negotiations were going on, or at least to be at the hearing and be able to object to the approval of the settlement because of the fact that the intervention was pending at the time and before they signed their agreement and entered into it. And so for those reasons, the rulemaking docket was not converted to anything. This commission has used those cost rules for CLEX ever since CLEX came into being. Now, admittedly, those rules were originally designed for local those rules were originally designed for a different paradigm in the telecommunications industry, but when CLEX came along, those were the rules that have been used. I agree that the commission is trying to get away from that, but right now they're the only ones we have, and those are the ones we've been using.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I forgive me, as a politically elected official, I have the right to fib once in a while, and I had more than one question now after after listening to that. I do have a question of staff. Could you please elaborate just a little bit, Ms. Kramer, on two issues? One is you had stated that they gave that Mid-Continent gave no reason in their petition to intervene. And in their petition, they state that the Mid-State will have a huge competitive advantage over Mid-Continent and any other CLEC. And would you also comment on I recognize this is not an evidentiary hearing here, and we're accepting the word of honorable people, and they are telling us that there is competition. Does that change your staff's advice to the commission?
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. My point earlier on was they gave no legal reason why they were late filed. I mean, they could have filed timely, and this wouldn't be an issue. But I
understand that, and I was not quite compelled to ask that question of Mr. Gerdes. I was interested in asking. I did not, but I am interested in those other two arenas.
And then as for the huge competitive advantage, that was a statement that staff witness Sanger made in the hearing, and then again was in our brief. I'd have to look. I'm not exactly sure where that came from, but I'm fairly certain that was something we had said and that we stand by when comparing facilities-based CLEX for sure. That those are not the facts here at all, of course. And then what was your other one?
The first was that staff had stated that, as you said, that that Mid-State would have a huge competitive advantage over Mid-Continent and any other CLEC earlier, and I was wondering how that would play. I appreciate your comment there. The other was that there's been testimony here that there is in fact competition. And I believe that in your statement to us, you had said competition does not exist, and therefore it, they really don't have a standing. So I'm curious how that plays at this juncture.
Again, and I'm with you, we'll take them at their word that they have customers there. What kind of customers, I don't know, but I believe that they are probably correct that they have some customers. I still have an issue with their having standing in that they had no legal reason that I can see why they late or why they're late filed. So to me, that takes them out of play. But because had they filed timely, I wouldn't be objecting on those grounds. I want to be careful because they do have actually a one where they have timely filed, and so I don't want to prejudice anything there. If
forgive me, I want to understand you correctly, and I don't know that I did. Are you saying that if they had not filed late, that you would not be objecting at this time?
If they had not filed, my main objection here to their intervention is that they're late filed and there is no reason for that. They just have offered no reason while they're late filed. And we have already struck a deal with Midstate, and so people are being prejudiced here. And, you know, he says, well, it happened after. Well, their intervention wasn't pending. When we were working on this, they simply had not intervened and hadn't filed anything. And we were almost complete by the time they had filed.
But is that public knowledge, that agreement that has been reached?
We did file it, but right. At the time we were working on it. But again, because no one had intervened timely, we weren't under. We didn't think we were under pressure to get it filed before their late filed came in. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the additional opportunities that you've given me for asking questions. Mr. Gerdes, it begs the question, why did you file late?
We filed late because it was by oversight, number one. But number two, Ms. Kramer is not giving effect to your rule on late filed interventions, because granting of this intervention, the issue is whether or not the intervention will unduly prejudice the rights of other parties to the proceeding. Now, it's my understanding that stipulation was signed and concluded after the petition to intervene was filed. So they were on notice that we wanted to intervene and that we wanted to be involved at that time. Now, this is not an evidentiary hearing. If the commission wants to have an evidentiary hearing, and we'll find out exactly when they made their deal. But my recollection in looking at the website is that stipulation is dated after the 7th of April.
And I see by your filing that it was April 7th.
The date of the filing of the stipulation is 1 week later, the 14th of April. And I believe that was the date that was on the stipulation. And in any event, I believe that, because that's the impression I had when I looked at it, that it was not signed until after April 7th, which is when our petition to intervene, a late-filed petition to intervene, was filed.
At any rate, the reason for your filing late was because it was an oversight.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's why you have your rule on late-filed interventions.
As long as it doesn't prejudice. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I need a break. So if it pleases the other commissioners, perhaps we could recess for 10 minutes and be back at 20 after 11. All right, we're back on the web, and we're back in, getting back a little late, but not too bad. Let's dive in. I'd like to narrow the issues a bit to just the two threshold issues, I think, that exist given our rules. The first is the question of interest, And I think regardless of all of this discussion about whether or not they have customers, no one's disputed the Mid-Continent's and IXT. That seems to me to be a peculiar interest. So at least in my mind, the first threshold issue of peculiar interest is taken care of. A second threshold issue is, because it's been late filed, is the issue of prejudice. And so, Ms. Wiest, I'd like you to talk to me a little bit about whether or not you feel parties would have been prejudiced by this late filed intervention, and then some, give me some idea of how late filed this intervention was.
Yeah, I looked it up. The intervention deadline was March 20th, so I guess it was late filed by a little over 2 weeks, which really isn't that long in the, you know, in the scheme of things for a docket filing. And we've dealt with interventions that have been late filed for a lot longer than that, I think, in some cases. And also the other factors, of course, is that they filed it prior to the settlement being filed. They did file for intervention prior to that.
I'm not a big fan of late filed interventions, but given that it was, relatively speaking, closely following the intervention deadline, I am not, even though I understand negotiations were taking place, and even though I know granting intervention to another party may render some of that labor inefficiently spent, I still think it's not late filed by a real long time, so I'm having a hard time buying the prejudice argument. So those are my thoughts. Other questions or comments by commissioners or advisors?
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the way that you examine this from the first and second issues that you touched upon, and it is a challenging situation, and there are a number of circular arguments with it. I do recognize that a deadline should be a deadline. Otherwise, what's the purpose of having it? However, it is quite precedented that this commission has allowed almost 2 months for folks to go past their deadlines, file past deadlines with certain conditions. I recognize this is not an evidentiary hearing, and that creates some of the challenges, and I was ready to, prior to the meeting, actually, and prior to the testimony that we received, to not grant the intervention. But as I look at this and hear the information today, I do believe that we need to allow intervention.
I just think, as we sit here and debate and go back and forth between Mr. Gerdes and Ms. Rogers, I think that's the whole purpose of intervention, that both of them have a point, both of them have an issue. As far as the late filing, I agree with Commissioner Hansen that if you're going to set a date, you should stick to it. But in legal terms, I don't believe that 2 weeks is overly burdensome. I do believe that the next question will actually be affected by granting intervention, though. But I do feel that we should grant intervention. So I'll motion in TC09-009 that the commission grant late filed intervention to Mid-Continent Communications.
Motion has been made. No second being required. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Second question on this item is, shall the commission approve the joint motion and settlement stipulation? Or in the alternative, how shall the commission proceed? Will either of the parties that are a party to that stipulation want to make any comments?
I believe that question becomes moot.
Is it a foregone conclusion that the commission could not take, if maybe Mid-Continent's got an intervention, maybe they'd come up and say, well, we don't have a problem with stipulation, go ahead. I mean, that seems unlikely, but I don't, sometimes it turns, Ms. Kramer, I guess is there a legal reason that we wouldn't want to hear from either of the parties to the stipulation? I mean, are you pulling the settlement stipulation back on your own request?
I just believe, based on your decision, was it 2 weeks ago in the wind farm, where you didn't accept the stipulation because all parties hadn't signed off on it. So that's my theory.
And my only tweak to that would be that I think part of the thing that concerns some of the parties that objected to the commission approving that settlement stipulation is that there were some findings of fact and conclusions of law specifically that parties had an issue with. We haven't heard that. We may yet. But I just don't want to make assumptions if there will be differentiating factors between that case and this one. Ms. Rogers, any comments?
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. I can certainly speak to the settlement stipulation and how we came to arrive at the particular points that are raised there. Again, we met with staff and negotiated this particular stipulation, and the goal was to maintain the status quo until, as I said, we know what the rules are with regard to what methodology should be adopted with regard to a cost study. And so what we agreed to in the stipulation is that Midstate would not increase, decrease, change at all its current rates, Midstate Telecom, and we're talking about the CLEC in the Chamberlain Exchange. And so we would maintain exactly the same rate that we have been charging pursuant to the stipulations in the past. And then we requested that that rate stay in effect until such time as this commission has established a methodology. And at that point, what we asked for was once that rule or those rules or the methodology for a cost study has been established, that we would then have 3 months after that time frame to actually contact our consultant, get a cost study in place, and file it, and then whatever rate that resulted in, that's what we would adopt. And so we saw this stipulation or settlement as one that would be best for the customers in Chamberlain, the least confusing. We're just going to maintain the status quo. Once we know what the rules are, then we'll come in and within 3 months file a cost study and ask that be the rate on a go-forward basis.
Thanks for that overview, Ms. Rogers. Appreciated. Mr. Gerdes?
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, it probably wouldn't surprise anyone for us to say that we would oppose the approval of the joint motion and settlement stipulation at this time. As we've mentioned during the discussion on the intervention itself, Midcontinent didn't have a seat at the table and was not heard insofar as its concerns are are relevant to this issue. When you're talking about a cost study and the elements that go into making costs, as I said earlier, I don't believe, and Midcontinent does not believe, that there was, in fact, any kind of a basis other than a negotiation for the current rate, and the current rate is no, it terminated, and so it's our position that the rate should be that of the incumbent Quest and not the negotiated rate. And so we believe that there should be a hearing on the issue, and the commission can then render its decision whether they agree with us or not. We will have a hearing, and then there's due process available that if Midcontinent doesn't believe that the decision is correct, they would have the opportunity to appeal, and of course the same would be available to Midstate as well. They would have their due process rights, but we would submit that there should be a hearing on this matter unless we can, as a party, the three can get together and agree on a stipulation.
Mr. Gerdes, given that this is, I believe that the rate that the settlement stipulation calls for is the rate that's currently in effect for MedState. Given the fact that a hearing is going to be some number, if such a thing is necessary, will be some number of weeks or months away, what's different? I mean, why wouldn't the commission just approve this stipulation to formalize what is already the rate that is going to be, that is being charged today and will be charged tomorrow?
Because, Mr. Chairman, it has always been staff's position that it should be the rate of the incumbent, and the rate of the incumbent is the Quest rate, which is 6.04 some cents, and that's the way, the rate that it should be.
But Mr. Gerdes, there is, and although some people have I think in their comments, poo-pooed isn't the proper legal term, but I mean there is a pending rule-making docket. I do have optimism that there'll be movement on that in the near future. I just wonder if, you know, this sort of feels a little bit to me like the Crooks issue with the video. I mean, I just sort of feel like are we wading into these legal battles, and is it really efficient? I mean, shouldn't we just, if this is the status quo, let's approve it and let's do the real heavy lifting in the rule docket.
That is a tempting philosophy, Mr. Chairman. But again, legally, I believe that rate terminated, and that it's a new question, and that it has always been the position of staff that it should, for a CLEC, that it should be the incumbent rate, and the incumbent rate is the Quest rate. Now, as far as dependency of the rulemaking, I have every confidence that we are ultimately someday going to have new rules that relate to CLECs. Historically, we've used the rules that are on the books now. Everybody in this room knows that. And just because, I mean, if the draft rules were issued or were put out for comment tomorrow, we wouldn't have a set of rules for who knows, 2 or 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, however long it takes to get the things put together. And then after that, people have to make the filings, have the filings approved. I mean, we could be talking 6 or 8 months easily.
I mean, you keep talking about the rate terminated, and I understand what you mean by that, but I mean, regulatory doctrine indicate that rate is in place until it's changed.
I'm not sure about that.
What would be the rate that would be that the company would have the authority to charge? No rate? They wouldn't have any ability to charge access?
I think then they would revert to the commission staff's position has always been it should be the CLEC rate. The ILEC rate.
That hasn't been a finding of this commission. I mean, I think that's still very much in flux. I mean, some people could read our rules to indicate that the LECA plus rate would be the default rate at that point.
Well, then perhaps
there have been some parties recently granted interveners to this party who've argued that from time to time.
Well, let me put it this way, Mr. Chairman. The incontinent didn't seek to intervene in this docket simply to approve this stipulation. Midcontinent wanted a seat at the table to see that the rate was more realistic than 11.5 cents. And so I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I would expect that I'm going to get together with Ms. Kramer and Ms. Rogers, and we're going to decide how we want to go forward with this. And maybe not. I see Ms. Kramer shaking her head, so maybe we won't get together. But in any event, I think that the answer is that there has to be a hearing.
Okay, thank you.
Unless the commission wants to approve the stipulation, which would be have the agreement of two of the three parties now in the docket, which is contrary to what the commission has done in the past, I believe.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Can you explain that a little bit more, Mr. Gerdes? I mean, I'm not aware that we have a whole lot of precedence in this sort of a situation.
Well, Ms. Kramer mentioned the situation most recently when all the parties hadn't signed the stipulation, and so therefore it was not approved.
So you're unaware of any examples other than that?
Not off the top of my head, but I'm sure I can probably find some.
Okay, thanks. Other questions?
If we were to defer action on this, what is the status of the rate,
John or Rolene, if the does the rate in fact, as Dusty had mentioned, Mr. Johnson had mentioned to Mr. Gertis, does it stay status quo until a rulemaking docket, or is a deferral of this action the stipulation is in limbo? So does that give a legal basis for Mid-Continent to keep the status quo?
I think that if the commission would defer action on the stipulation, that it would keep the status quo.
Okay. Until such time as we decided to take it back up.
As you took action on it.
Okay. So, Ms. Wiest, part of me wants to approve this stipulation, because I'm not sure I've heard any compelling arguments that the content of the stipulation isn't in alignment with the public interest. That being said, I don't want to get the commission in any legal trouble. Do you believe that there are significant legal obstacles toward us approving a stipulation that not all the parties have agreed to?
Well, you know, Mr. Gertis mentioned a few times about not having a seat at the table. I just think it would make more sense if the commission deferred action today and allowed the parties to perhaps get together and try to figure this out. I mean, there are timelines within the settlement agreement. Perhaps those timelines are something that the parties want to work on and change the timelines. So, again, I'm not recommending not approving it, but I do think there are benefits in deferring it today.
Thanks for the recommendation. Other questions?
I guess, could you expound on what the benefits of deferring as opposed to just approving?
Well, because Mr. Gertis has stated that he is now an intervener. At this point, I would think that the parties to the docket now would get together, and hopefully they can come up with something that they can agree on for an interim period at this point of time until something is done with the rules, or perhaps, I don't know, Mid-State would just file for another three-year file for the LECA Plus rate.
For another three-year extension, right. Basically.
It, not necessarily an extension, but an exemption from the cost
from
rules
the cost
and file for the LECA Plus rate.
Okay.
I don't think that's what Mid-Continent wants, but that is something that I think is probably out there. And I think the realities of the situation, all the parties are going to have to figure out the realities of the situation, get together and figure it out.
And that kind of leads me to... We have a party that wants to be an intervener but doesn't agree with the stipulation that two have agreed to already. So obviously if they don't agree to the stipulation, they're not going to come to an agreement. So does that put the commission in a position that only two out of three is the best we're going to do and we should approve this?
There's differing case law on that situation. I have looked into this issue. Some commissions, you can approve a non-unanimous settlement. There might be some complications with that. Sometimes you can approve it and go to hearing on what the intervener's issues are. So there are different ways to address that.
Sure. I think so.
Okay. Thanks. Other questions? Yes, Mr. Islov.
Being a non-attorney, I have a concern. I know I understand the issues on both sides. I understand their concerns on both sides. This has been a long-time issue that's appeared in front of this commission. But the concern I have, and maybe coming from an analyst viewpoint right now, is that I think Mid-Continent's viewpoint is well represented on the record in various dockets. My concern, depending on when the rulemaking would be open, would be the materiality of changing any rates at this point until that rulemaking is finished. In other words, and we're talking about evidence at this point, but if this is a principled stand, I understand that, but would the cost of hearing and further proceedings outstrip the true difference? And now, I have some economic training as well, so I understand that if there's competition concerns, we could talk about that. But from what I understand, there's been a difference in access rates for some period of time, and the issue is now arising, at least for the first time in this case. My point being, I think materiality should be considered. I think the parties should consider that if they further negotiate this settlement. I think we understand where everyone's coming from. I just hate to see this get in the way of a rulemaking. We're doing basically a parallel. We're doing parallel hearings on virtually the same issue. I think that's virtually an utter and total waste of time. And frankly, because we know the issues and because we know where this rulemaking has to be directed, I don't think a hearing in this case is going to teach anybody anything that they don't already know. And so I'd be very concerned, for whatever it's worth.
Well, I think you're right, Mr. Islov. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. The most likely outcome of, granting Mid-Continent intervention, and I don't know that I was really excited to do it. I just felt like that's what the rules indicated were the appropriate thing. The threshold issues have been reached, but let's not kid ourselves. This probably slows this docket down until the rulemaking is resolved.
And Commissioner, it's not that I disagree with the intervention. I think it's more a statement to the parties as they go forward and bring something forward to you three commissioners for consideration. It's not necessarily related to any ruling you would make today, but I have grave concerns about expending further time and money on something that should be dealt with in a rulemaking. It just seems like an administrative waste, at least partially in my mind.
All right, unless there are there any further comments? Hearing none, I would move the commission to defer action on the settlement stipulation. So any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0.
And I just wanted to make a comment that this is kind of a, I understand that it's the commission's job to get those rules out the door, but we've got about 7 gallons of water in a 5-gallon pail right now at the commission. So the rules will be out soon, I would hope, and we just need to comment them on them and just to give maybe some people a glimmer of hope that we're very, very, very aware of the situation. And I have very confident that hopefully by a very near future it'll be handled.
I love it when Commissioner Colbeck puts on his straw hat and his overalls and gives us folksy wisdom. All right, let's proceed then to administrative item number one, and this deals with the establishment of a gross receipts tax for the 2010 fiscal year. Ms. Forney.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, this is Heather Forney on behalf of staff. I am here, as I am this time every year, to discuss the establishment of the gross receipts tax levy for the fiscal year upcoming, which is fiscal year 10. On April 1st of each year, we request that all of the utility companies doing business in the state file with us their gross intrastate revenues for the past calendar year. So now we are discussing their gross intrastate revenues for calendar year 2008. Based on that information, we back into a levy assessment because by statute we are not allowed to have more in our gross receipts tax fund than our current budget plus our future fiscal year budget. At this point, that total is about $4 million. Our current assessment request would be the same as it has been in past years, which is the maximum that is allowed by statute, which is 0.15% or a $250 minimum filing fee. And that would be my request at this point, is to establish the 0.15% with a $250 minimum as the gross receipts tax assessment for fiscal year 10, which would be due and payable on July 15th of 2009.
Thanks, Ms. Forney. Any comments from any affected person? And there are lots of them. Hearing none, questions by commissioners or advisors? Hearing none, is there any commissioner comment or action?
I'll motion in the administrative that the commission establish the rate and assess the gross receipts tax as authorized in SDCL 4901A-3 to 0.15% or $250 minimum.
Motion has been made. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. We will move at this time to our the addendum of the agenda, which is electric EL08-030. This is Otter Tail Corporation's filing for the ability to increase its electric rates, but the question for the commission today is, shall the commission approve the request for implementation of interim rates based on existing rate design and a proration method? Otter Tail Power.
Thank you, Chair Johnson, commissioners, staff. As you're well aware, Otter Tail filed a rate case on October 31, 2008. It's the first rate case we filed.
Is your mic on?
The light is on. I'm not close enough. I'll start again. As you're well aware, Otter Tail filed its rate case on October 31, 2008. It's the first rate case that we filed in the state of South Dakota since 1987. We appreciate, first of all, the courtesies that have been extended us since we're, for the most part, new to this.
Sorry to interrupt. Did we have? Did you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry, I did not. Bruce Gerhardson, Associate General Counsel for Otter Tail Corporation, and with me is Ron Spangler, our rate case manager. South Dakota law permits a utility to implement its proposed rates after 30 days or after a commission suspension, after filing its rate case, and even before the commission has expressly approved those rates. In this case, the commission did that. It suspended our rate filing for 180 days, and that period will be up on April 29th. During the time since we filed, we've been in discussions with staff. We've answered I think hundreds and hundreds, it feels like, of information requests, and they've been working with staff to reach an agreement on revenue requirements, class allocations, and rate design. I'm happy to report that we are settled, I think, on all issues. The one remaining for details to be worked out is rate design. While I think we're at agreement on in principle on the general nature of the rate design, the details of rate design require some iterations on analysis. Today what we're requesting is not for the authority to actually implement an interim rate, but to structure our interim rate in such a way as to best reflect the circumstances of this case. What we would like to do, rather, what the statute would normally, I think, anticipate is that we would implement an interim rate that is based on our initial filing. That would mean we would implement a revenue requirement, the class allocations, and a rate design based on our interim filing. But what we're requesting is to implement using our existing rate design, that is the rate design that's currently in Otter Tail's rates, not the ones that we've proposed, and then to base our revenue requirement and class allocations and even our rate allocations, those within the class, based upon the agreement we've reached with staff. Now, it isn't necessary that the commission approve that agreement or anything. It's just that we think that's the most likely outcome of this case, given that we have reached agreement and no party would oppose that agreement. Maybe I should better explain, I think, how this will work. Mr. Spangler's here to help me with that, as he's the guy who will actually implement it. But what we're really requesting is customers who are receiving bills today, once we implement an interim rate as we propose, would see simply a percentage adder to their bill. And that would mean that the rate design of our current rates would still be reflected in the rates with that increase. The percentage increase would not be a flat rate across all customers. What we would do is, because we know not only the overall revenue requirement increase, but we also know the class allocations and indeed the allocations to rates, we would apply the percentage increase that applies to the customer rate that customer is taking service. It's relatively straightforward. It's much more straightforward than what the statute would anticipate in our case, where we're making some substantial rate design changes. The benefits of this, I think, are fairly substantial. First of all, it will be much more simple for us to administer it, for your staff to review it, and it'll be much less confusing for our customers. Again, it will be simply taking a percentage and adding it to a current bill. Also, I should point out for the very first bill that anyone will receive that reflects consumption after May 1, which is the date we plan to implement, which is a couple days later than the 180-day period, people will see simply a proration where a certain percentage of their bill will have the adder, a certain percentage will not. If we had to do a certain percentage of the bill using old rate design and a certain percentage of the bill using new rate design, it would be very difficult to administer. It would also be, I think, very confusing for a customer. So this should benefit customers substantially.
I'm sorry, could you do that one more time? That one?
You plan to implement it on May 1st and then go through that one more time for me?
That's right. We plan to implement the interim increase beginning May 1st. April 29th actually is the last day of the 180-day suspension period, but for the convenience of beginning this with a calendar month, we plan to begin the implementation on May 1. Because customer bills go out in cycles during the course of the month, you know that. For the bills that are received reflecting May, some customers will receive some number of days, others more days of May. And so what we will do is we'll prorate depending on the number of days reflected for May and number of days reflected for April. We will prorate that bill so that they're not receiving any increase for the consumption prior to the May 1st date.
Okay, that's what I wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
I was thinking that you would you wouldn't take an average. Is that what you're saying? You've got half of May and half of April. You'd take an average or cut your rate in half and then take that.
We do have some examples, but roughly, yes, it is a prorating. It's based on the assumption is that we can't go out and read meters necessarily the day of May 1 on all customers. That would be an possibility for us. And so what we do is, and we do this in many other contexts, we read the meter and we attribute basically a flat consumption through the entire period of that bill, that billing cycle.
Okay. I get you.
Okay. Again, I mentioned that this should be easier to review by staff, by the commission, after the interim rate period as well. And why that's important is because we can't presume today that you'll approve the settlement. I think in all likelihood you will. I think because it's agreed to by all parties and I think it's reasonable, I think you will. And if that's the case, this implementation approach should require no refunds, provided it's approved by you today. If in the unlikely event you were to not approve the increase or the class allocations that we've proposed, we now have a flat increase that we expect we could apply a refund to rather than a rate design which you likely wouldn't approve and then have to work out those differences. So it should make for an easier refund in the, what I'll say, unlikely event such would be necessary. And that is consistent with what the rules, I should say the statutes say in this state with respect to interim rate refunds when they are required. There is a statute, I think it's 4934A22, which anticipates the notion of a flat refund if a refund is required. That is, if revenue requirements are finally determined to be less than what was implemented in that interim period. I should also say this is really consistent with where we are in the case. It will reflect the most likely outcome of the case. If we were to implement what we had originally proposed, we know that that is not a likely outcome. So what the statute anticipates is a less likely outcome than what we're proposing today. I think the other benefit is that this approach reflects basically an adherence to commission authority. That is, under each approach, if we use this, I should say, the approach to our interim rate and our approach to final rates, at all periods of time, the rate design that we're proposing would be one that has received the express approval of this commission. If what we were to do is implement what the statute would otherwise suggest, that is an increase using our proposed increase and proposed rate design, we don't anticipate that that will ever come in front of the commission now for approval. So we would be implementing a rate design that won't likely ever have the express approval of this commission. So we think that's a benefit of the approach we're proposing. The other thing is we're familiar with this approach. This is essentially the same kind of approach that we use in the other states we do business. In those states, we apply a flat across the board, actually, percentage increase to all customers during the rate, the interim rate period. And then if refunds are necessitated, then we do a flat refund across the board as well. So for those reasons, we think it's in the public interest to approve the approach to rate design for the interim rate period. Now, I imagine you may have questions about why we need to have an interim rate at all. And I think it may be worth mentioning that. First of all, it allows us to continue to work with staff to better refine the rate design that we want in this case. And it, because it's been a number of years, over 20 years, since we last set rate design in the state, there's some benefit to getting the details worked out properly. And so if this approach weren't approved, there would be some rush to try and get final rates in sooner. And that actually would occur in maybe other cases as well. I think our approach will allow for a better final result. We also should mention the nature of the rate increase or what's led to the rate increase in Otter Tail's case. Since we haven't had a rate increase since 1987, you might say, what does another few months matter? And that would be true if, I mean, one thing that's going on in our rate case is, of course, there's been inflationary pressure over those 20 years that we simply can no longer accommodate. But another thing that's going on in our case is we've made a substantial investment that I think you're aware of in wind generation. And it's important that Otter Tail begin to collect revenues to support that investment as soon as it can. And I think it's important you also recognize that customers receive the benefit of that investment already. There was two wind farms. One was made operational in the at the end of 2007, the other at the end of 2008. Those produce kilowatt hours, which are reflected in our fuel clause adjustment at zero cost, because there is no fuel associated, obviously, with the wind generation. So the customers have been seeing the benefit in their reduced fuel clause since those things came up, became operational. So there doesn't seem to be a reason to delay cost recovery for those facilities. It may also warrant mention that Otter Tail has additional investments that you're well aware of that it anticipates making in the near future. And for that reason, cost recovery has been really on the an important factor for us, that we get a fair and timely cost recovery for investments we make. Our banks, of course, in this financial climate, are getting more and more concerned about that. And so to the extent we can, we want to reflect that we can get the most timely cost recovery that is possible. And so in this state, after the suspension period, we think it's appropriate, and especially under these circumstances, to implement an interim rate and to do so on the method that we've proposed. So we would ask that the commission approve that.
Okay, it's important to note at this time that our phone bridge does drop at a little after noon. We don't think that's a problem because we don't see anybody on the telephone line that has any business yet to come before the commission. Is anybody still left on the line, though? Ms. Moore? Ms. Moore?
I am present, Mr. Chairman. I apologize.
Oh, not a problem.
Mute button on.
No problem. Well, because it's just you, I think the good news is we don't need a phone bridge to do that. We can probably just, we need to get a hold of the phone number for that she can call into to have us patched in, to have her patched in here. Damaris, are we working on that?
Yep, I can do
that. Okay, great. Okay, Ms. Moore, you may drop off in a little bit. We certainly won't do anything without getting you back on the line, though.
Okay, then should I expect a phone call or an email telling me when to call in?
Yes, we'll call.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you very much. Bye.
Okay, thanks. My apologies for the interruption. Had you concluded your comments?
I had concluded my comments, yes.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. Staff.
Thank you, Chairman. I think the company's done a pretty adequate job of explaining what their proposal is, and I guess unless there's some questions, we would just concur with their request in, for the sake of customer confusion and administrative efficiency.
And that leads to a question, Mr. Jacobson and Ottertail. I mean, will this reduce customer confusion? I mean, I understand the that putting into effect the interim rate, the originally filed rate, would cause confusion. But if it's only a matter of a month or so before the details the final details are worked out on the rate case, is having three rates in 3 months going to reduce customer confusion? Mr. Jacobson?
Well, again, I'm not an attorney, but they do have the legal right to put rates into effect. If we look at the alternatives to how that would take place, I think we clearly agree that the initially filed rates would lead to much greater customer confusion. I think this is about as simple of a method as we could come up with, and the most easily explainable to customers, as opposed to any other alternative we could really come up with. So,
our experience in other states tells us that this will not create undue confusion. There will be, of course, customer questions whenever a rate increase occurs or whenever something shows up on their bill different from the prior period. But at the same time, we've not noted unusual or any level of confusion that would should concern you. And like I say, that's a benefit of doing it the way we're talking about. We have experience with it in our other states.
Do we have, and I know things are a bit in flux, I mean, does anyone have an estimate of how long we think it will take the parties to resolve the resolving issues? The remaining issues, rather. Go ahead.
It's difficult to say. Normally, in a rate case, we would have had the rate design done by now because, as you understand, there was quite drastic changes proposed in the initial. We've made significant progress towards narrowing the gap, if you want to put it that way. But we still believe that we have a ways to go. I don't know how long that might take. Hard to tell.
I mean, presumably then we're talking more about a number of weeks rather than a number of days or 1 month or something.
Yes, before we get everything ironed out, we have, you know, tariffs to approve and all that kind of thing with the new rates in there. I would suspect that what their work paper show is that the final rates would be in place by June 1st, I believe, is what they're trying to shoot for.
Actually, I think it's Chair Johnson, Commissioners. We're shooting for July 1st, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
But nevertheless, we need to get not only to resolution of these issues, which I, number one, believe is not a problem. I mean, I think there are issues that need to go through some analysis to get there. It isn't a matter of being principled in different places, in my opinion. Once we have that, we need to then adequately document that, get it in front of you for approval, and then implementation of final rates. So I think right now we're targeting July 1. So it is a number of weeks. The kinds of revenues that are at stake are in the hundreds of thousands per month, which in Ottertail's case is significant, being that we are a relatively small company, and obviously our returns in this state are only a portion of that. So it is not an option, in our opinion, to forego revenues during that period.
Other questions, commissioners or advisors? Commissioner Kolbeck?
Yeah.
And Commissioner Hansen and Mr. Ruzalov and Mr. Smith and everybody else gets a bite at the apple. Go ahead.
If I understand right, the one option is to implement the original rate design in the original filed rate of the rate case. Correct. That's your, it's your, you have a legal standing that you could do that.
That is correct. That would be the sort of the normal way to do it, I will say.
Is that something that you would entertain, or would you rather just stay until the rate design was completed?
We would entertain it, although I will tell you that I think then you would have the difficulty of customer confusion, because we'd go not only to a different revenue requirement, but we'd be going to a relatively substantial set of rate design changes and then going back. And I think that those things would cause confusion, and we don't have experience with that in other states because that isn't how they do it.
And that would be relative to refund with interest. That's the statutory language, I believe.
That's correct. If we collect revenues in addition to what we are authorized by this commission, then we refund. That is correct.
Okay. Now, if you were to implement using the existing rate design, but the new rate, that's actually what you're after, correct?
That is correct.
The original rate design, but yet the new rate.
And if I may clarify for a moment, Commissioner, when we say the new rate, what we mean is the rate that we've agreed to, which is somewhat less.
Yes.
It's not approved yet.
Okay.
And
okay.
We hope that would avoid the need for any rate.
You are the only person in the meeting now.
That doesn't mean we're not listening.
No, it's then. I'll never make the Oscars, but now I know what they feel like.
Let's see here. Oh, if we were... okay, I asked you that question here. I'm a little confused on the... You plan to implement it on May 1st, but then you said July 1st later.
We expect final rates to be implemented by July 1st. The bridge period is between May 1st and July 1st.
Okay. And that prorated, you're still within your 180 days of getting that rate case. So you may use half of an April bill for a customer. Is that the extreme, or would it maybe be a week into April or 2-3 days?
It will depend upon where they fall in the cycle. They could have any number of days from April on their bill, right?
Okay.
They could have one day, or they could have 29.
Okay, so it could be the full 29 days of April.
I think so. So they'd have a very small amount of their bill in that case where they would have a proration should apply to them.
Yeah, if their bill came out on, say their bill came out on May 1st, their actual reading would probably reflect to April 1st or April 2nd, around there.
Yeah, to be clear, there's probably a two-week delay before any, so if it's on May 1st, they might actually have, they'd certainly not have any May days on May 1st. But if their bill reflected consumption that included May 1st and the remainder of April, it would have just one day of the increase.
But there is the potential that a customer could have all of April at the interim rate.
No, actually, in each instance, the point of prorating would mean that you'd have no amount of increase related to the April period.
Okay.
Because we would not apply it to the total consumption on the bill. We'd apply it only to the one, in the one case, in the example you had, only to the one day.
Okay.
Essentially by prorating the amount of consumption over that period.
That's what I wanted to make very clear. Now, this interim rate that you're proposing, is that subject to refund also?
It is. We made that clear in our filing that if you were to approve something other than what we've agreed to with staff, that this would not compromise your ability to order a refund.
Okay. I can see where this would help give staff and the company time to work on a rate design. I understand that. And Mr. Jacobson had mentioned, I think, a month. Is that your understanding, too?
I think we're talking in relatively similar time frames, yes.
Okay. You said that the wind farm costs that we are obviously aware of, I'm not obviously aware of those.
I believe everybody watches us as well, closely as I do.
Unless you thought you were in North Dakota.
Yeah. We have added two wind farms, one which we refer to as the Langdon facility. Do you want some description of that?
Yes.
Yeah. The earlier of the two that was added was called the Langdon facility. My recollection is it's right around 49 and a half megawatts. I got that right? Does that sound right? It's near Langdon, North Dakota. That's where it gets its name. It's been producing, I believe, since November or December of 2007. The second of the two that ends up as a rate-based investment for us is called the Ashtabula Wind Farm. That is, as its name implies, near Lake Ashtabula in North Dakota. That's been producing electricity since the end of 2008. Again, I think around November. The reason for mentioning that is, since they've gone up, the fuel clause adjustments should be reflecting really nice adjustments downward as kilowatt hours are coming into our fuel adjustment at zero cost.
Okay. And that, I won't beat you up too bad, but
appreciate that.
We'd appreciate a little in South Dakota there too, if possible. And then the next thing you mentioned was initial investments. Could you talk about those? The other investments, I guess, to justify the rate increase, you had mentioned the wind farms, and then you had other initial investments that you had started.
I'm sorry, I may have mentioned there have been other investments.
Okay.
Those are the significant generation investments, of course, utilities making investments, and it's, you know, transmission investments and otherwise. Okay. I didn't mention this. The third thing that I mentioned is since 1987, we've had obviously inflationary pressures over that period. There are certain things, as you all are aware of, cost of labor, et cetera, that continue to rise. There's some offsetting things that have allowed us to stay out of the rate arena in that period, but that is also putting some, creating the need for the rate increase. I didn't want you to be left with the impression that it was all related just to those investments. Even without them, I believe we may have needed a rate increase to adjust for expenses.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, actually, appreciate questions by Commissioner Colbeck because he asked all except for I'd like to piggyback just a little bit on the one pertaining to wind farms. Is there any new capacity that is in South Dakota that is going to be reflected in this rate request?
Otter Tail has not added any wind generation in the state of South Dakota to date.
Any other capacity, though, natural gas or anything of that nature that's being reflected in this rate request?
No. We're an electricity only. We don't have any natural gas generation.
And obviously you didn't put in a coal plant or a nuclear
we're
plant.
We're doing our best, as you know.
But the both of the plants then are in North Dakota, and that energy is that capacity is being consumed where
throughout our system, and we build our generation facilities to serve all of our customers in all of our jurisdictions. That includes our existing plant at Big Stone, our Coyote plant in North Dakota, Hoot Lake and Fergus Falls, several peaking plants, and our wind generation that we've added.
All right. Thank you.
This is Greg Russell with the staff. I'm not going to get into the revenue requirements, the stipulation. I'll save that beating for later when it's scheduled. But I do have a concern that you're using the word interim rather liberally from my point of view. Now, there are two terms we should apply interim to, and if the commission approves the stipulated revenue requirements portion of the case, excuse me, that revenue requirements won't be interim at that point. It'll be final. There may be an interim rate design of sorts, but I don't want any confusion. You're not anticipating a refund if they approve the stipulated revenue requirements, and whatever rate design goes into effect will be permanent forever how long it is, whether it's a month or 2 months. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And so the only time there would be any sort of interim-related revenue requirements is if you held to your, and I'll use this word, I'll apologize, held to your threat of putting those rates into effect on May 1, and the commission subsequently ruled something other than what the stipulation or other than your full rate increase, let's put it that way, then there would be a refund obligation. That's correct.
Those are the two scenarios, if I understood you, that could result in a refund if we were to do.
I didn't speak well and it wasn't clear, but basically if you put your full request into effect
on May 1 prior to commission approval of that full request, which I don't think anybody's anticipating. I'm not trying to trick you here. But there will be a refund obligation if the commission would order something less than that. That's correct.
That is correct.
Okay, just wanted to make that clear. Do you have any idea what it would cost to effect a refund with interest? I've been through a few of those since the mid-70s. They're very, very expensive, and I would suggest you, it would make the battle over Big Stone 2 almost look like fun. But with that said, what if the commission, this is all interim, if the commission doesn't approve that stipulation between Otter Tail and staff, this is all academic, correct, as far as approval of this rate design today?
I don't know that it's academic. I think actually even in that instance, it would simplify substantially the notion of refunds, because my belief is under that scenario, the commission would likely allow us the authority to refund on a percentage basis, a flat percentage basis, then mining down to the individual customer basis. And in this instance, because all we're going to do is apply a single percentage adder to anyone's bill, it would simplify that refund process. And it's your concern that we're attempting to address, I think.
That's a good point. What you're saying basically is the current rate design plus the new bill frequency and the cost class of service would be calculated into any refund difference between the rate you would put into effect and the refund. That would become a base. What you're talking about as approval today would become a baseline for a refund.
I believe that's correct, yes.
If I understood correctly what you said. Now, you also understand there may be significant issues the commission could have with any rate design portion of this case as well. So with that said, how firm is July 1, August 1, September 1? Are those all possibilities?
They are possibilities. I think it wise that we not give ourselves that latitude and really shoot for the July 1 for lots of reasons. So they are possibilities, although I think it more likely that we get this done by July 1.
Unless the commission, of course, determines that the rate design proposals are just too out there and would want to make significant changes?
Yes, I think that is another scenario. If the stipulation weren't approved and the commission decided to go to hearing, for instance, or something like that, it would delay this. I think, however, that given the work we're doing with staff, I think that we have the most likely outcome will be approval. I cannot guarantee that, of course, today.
Okay, one final question. We've gone over the six-month time limit, which, as you know, is very, very short for proceeding like this. You should say thank you for that, but the South Dakota legislature back in the early 80s. But whatever the case may be, we've gone over that six-month limit, and most utilities determined that it wasn't worth their while for a short period of time to implement those rates. And I understand your pinch, since you've not had a rate increase since the Tax Reform Act of 86 cases. But still, Bombright doesn't suggest making three major rate changes this close together. I'm very concerned about that. I was here when Otter Tail filed for a 90% rate increase in the late 70s, and people really do line up with pitchforks at that point. And so I'm very concerned about being at a rate now, being at another rate reflecting a stipulation, assuming that's approved, and then changing rate design, because I've looked at some of those proposals, and I can attest to what I've seen is they're fairly dramatic changes in cost of service to some customers. So the thought is, if this could be done by June 1 and forego this month, it would seem to me to lessen, I'm not going to say the commission's problems, but I think Otter Tail would go to work, you know, my opinion, much more comfortably without looking over their shoulder. But that's just a thought, and I have no evidence. This isn't an evidentiary hearing. But what are your – did Otter Tail give that any thought?
We did give it some thought. We are in, as you may know, we're in a difficult spot. I'm not authorized to forego this additional revenue right now, the difficulty being that – we are, as you know, attempting to get to the final permitting for a large investment in this state. We do feel that timely revenue for our investments is being looked at with exacting scrutiny by lenders right now that I think that this is figuring into our financial personnel's decision-making on these subjects, and we want to reflect. We're just concluding, as you know, rate cases in our other two jurisdictions. Again, the first rate cases that we've seen in 20 or more years in each of those jurisdictions. So rightfully so, I think the banks are saying, can you get timely rate recovery for your investments in your jurisdictions? We don't have a history to see that from your jurisdictions with you. So right now, there are optics about the recovery in addition to that it is real money. I mean, I don't want to say it's only optics. It's my goal in all of our rate cases to have a good result and a timely result. We've been doing our best to get to that. I sure do appreciate, Mr. Rivasloff, all of what you said about what your commission, what your staff has done in a very short timeline. I'm very aware of that, and we're very appreciative of all the work and the attention they've given us. I am aware of what you're saying. We have done refunds in other states. I will say those have always been a flat percentage refund. In Minnesota, we finished a contested case not that long ago, and, of course, we had an interim rate, what we call an interim rate in Minnesota, for quite a period of time. And it required a refund, and are we through the implementation of that? Or?
Yes.
And so we're not without experience in that. Now, the commission is probably at liberty to do an interim any kind of a refund after that period that might be more complicated, although what I'm trying to do with the proposal that we've put in front of you is to simplify in almost any circumstance, if a refund were necessitated, simplify the administration of that refund. So we're trying to do our best in that regard.
If I can make one more observation, since the law took effect in 75, I don't recall having ever had to make a refund of this nature in a rate case. It's never happened. I mean, the refunds go back to pre-75 cases that spilled over into after I came here in 76. And then there were some related to some PGA matters with another company. But I guess there's always a look that at the refund procedure and how complicated it is, especially if it's a short period of time before that rate implemented. And I think there's some sense, I'm interested in this. Is Otter Tail sincere about putting that in effect on May 1 if the commission doesn't approve this rate design or the stipulation? Is that going to happen? Do you have rates ready to go?
I will confess, Mr. Rizloff, we would not have rates ready to go with the original proposal. We would be caught flat-footed in that circumstance, and I would have to talk with Mr. Spangler and others about what it would take. I know that this may seem an extraordinary thing to do in the state of South Dakota. Without minimizing that, it is not an extraordinary thing in our other jurisdictions. My expectation was that while the notion of interim rates would not be anything any commissioner would want to see, that the efforts we've made to simplify the process would be appreciated and preferred over the alternative. So we didn't prepare for the commission to deny the request and to implement that. I'll confess that. It wasn't because we meant to assume anything. It just was, frankly, an outcome that, frankly, may have its problems from our end as well, I'll say, administrative and otherwise. I don't know if I'm being clear.
And just by way of clarification, I mean, there would only be a refund if the revenue requirement was adjusted by the commission. There would not be a revenue requirement if there were tweaks made to the rate design.
Chair Johnson, that's my understanding.
Because this interim rate doesn't have anything to do with the new rate design. It's using an old rate design. I just want to make sure we had a clarification because we had some questions about, well, if there's a change to the rate design, then there's a refund. That would not be the case under this commission action.
I would also say under the statute, I don't think that would happen. The statute says very clearly that a refund is necessary if the revenue requirement is low, that's eventually approved by this commission, is less than that originally proposed. So I don't think the statute anticipates a redoing of rate design and trying to trace every dollar. It is simply a revenue requirement at reapplication. And again, I think 22, that is 4935A22, I think I have that right, anticipates the notion of, even in those circumstances, a flat across the board refund in that scenario. Again, I believe that we're on track to get our revenue requirement approved in this state.
Just a minute. Okay, and with that, just you've got some examples in your filing of the adjustment, and so that we're clear what would happen, for instance, for the residential service. Excuse me. You're going to be paying your cost of energy adjustment as a residential customer the same as you did last month, if this is approved. The only thing that would change is that there would be a 10.34% increase in your other charges. And the adjustment would be a little bit different. For instance, for farm service, that would be 11.48%. And for general service under 20 kilowatts, that would be 6.92%. So a relatively easy mathematical adjustment.
I believe that's correct, and if there's any more details, I'll ask Mr. Spangler to comment. He's worked out these examples.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. Just to clarify on that May bill in this example, if you're looking at the residential service, it's page one of Schedule 1 that we had filed. That's where we show how we would prorate that percentage.
Outside of the proration.
Yes.
Yeah, I understand May is a special circumstance. But on a go-forward basis, June, July, hopefully not any more months than that.
That would be correct, yes.
Okay. So describe to me, you know, the second box in each of the examples, it uses the same percentage increases, but the numbers at the end of the adjustments, I mean, I understand the COE is taken out in the second box, and so that may adjust these numbers a little bit, but I'm curious as to why the total bill before taxes varies slightly in each of the three examples. For instance, it's 107 for the residential service in the June bill, and the July bill it's 112.16.
That has to do with the proration that is occurring in the first bill. So the first box has some period of time that is not getting the increase, the new revenue requirement.
That's true for May, but what about for June?
In June, there would be no prorating because there's no period before April, before the May 1st date.
So why does the June bill differ from the July bill?
The rate per kilowatt hour actually changes because now we're looking at the final designs based on the final revenue requirement for July, whereas the rates per kilowatt hour and the customer charges for June were based on our current rate design.
So this does presume the July 1 effective date that we discussed earlier?
That's correct.
Okay. Gotcha. Thanks very much. Other questions? So okay, gotcha. If there are no further questions, are there comments? Go ahead, Commissioner.
I just have one for Mr. Jacobson. This rate, as Mr. Rizloff was making the point, this rate we don't anticipate to change. The 10.34, as Mr. Johnson had stated, we do not anticipate that to change once we approve that today, correct?
We don't anticipate it. I don't think today is approval on your part of that percentage increase, but we don't anticipate it changing. That percentage applies to that specific customer class, and that is what we have, as staff, have agreed to.
Okay. But it would be, sorry to interrupt, Commissioner, the ball would still be in the Commission's court if next month we decided that no, X rate of return was not appropriate given the risk portfolio of the company, and if the commission reduced that revenue requirement, then that 10.34 could be reduced to any reasonable and legally defensible number the commission wanted. That would trigger the refund.
So then could you expand on what you had said, Mr. Isenoff? I guess I totally misunderstood what you were your point then.
I don't know if I caught all what you said. Maybe easier if I start from the beginning. The revenue requirement that is stipulated, if it's approved by you at some future point, whether that's 2 weeks or a week, whatever the
so
case
not
may
today.
Be.
Not today.
No, that's not. All they're talking about today is rate design. And frankly, I'll be flip. It won't be accurate. The company's worried about revenue requirements. That's their primary concern. Not that they aren't concerned about rate design, but it's revenue requirements. And as they've gone through this case, they've determined, and staff going through the class cost of service studies, how much each class should be allocated of that rate increase. Okay, what rate design does? You've got, let's say five different customer groups. You're going to assign the rate increase and the cost of service to each of the five customer groups. What we're talking about today is the rate design to take those costs and assign them to customers within that class. So what you're doing today isn't approving the revenue requirements. You're just approving truly an interim rate design, and that's making the assumption rate design will change when they get all the differences ironed out that they're talking about. The revenue requirements that you look at whenever, that will still remain the same. No matter what the rate design is, that will remain the same. If I don't know if I'm clearing this up, but there's two portions, rate design and revenue requirements. The key for everyone is the revenue requirement, and then you're going to go allocate it to customers on the basis of rate design. When I talked about their rate design, I don't know what word I use, being fairly dramatic or whatever, changes that they're proposing versus the current rate design. What I'm saying is within a customer class, not that it shouldn't be designed to yield any more revenues no matter what the rate design, it will change what certain individual customers will pay within that class on a rather remarkable scale. And so what you're doing today has nothing to do with the rate increase, so to speak. All this is going to do is determine the rate design that customers will use to pay their bills until a new rate design is developed. So in that sense, it's interim, but I kind of hate to even use the word interim rate design. Every rate design you establish under a certified revenue requirement, in my view, is permanent, even if it's only there for a month, because it doesn't anticipate refunds.
See, and that's where I think I depart from your analysis, Mr. Islov. I mean, the commission's not approving any, I mean, there are a whole host of issues unresolved here. I mean, this is a very temporary, very interim step, which if the commission does any single thing almost other than what with regard to revenue requirement, and other than what staff and the applicant has agreed upon, this is very much interim because this money's coming back.
This is only rate design. And I don't believe anyone's advocating that changes be made backward based on rate design. So in that sense, once you implement these, they will be permanent for that month. See, when we use the word interim, it implies that there could be a refund or there could be a change, at least for me. This rate will go down in history as the permanent rate for May 2009. I'm just in trying to simplify. Now, that doesn't mean you can change rate design every month if you want.
The rate design, I understand, today for that month or two, we would be saying is in concrete. But the rate is interim. I mean, 10.34 for the residential customer is interim because that could be changed. That could be that particular increase could be clawed back.
Let's use the term revenue requirement. That makes it much easier, I think. You're talking about the revenue requirement.
Right, absolutely.
And that is subject to change until you approve the stipulation. But we've been using the word rate and revenue requirement interchangeably, and I think that confuses everything. Revenue requirement is entirely different than the rate the customers pay. The rates are designed to build into the revenue requirement.
But I understand that it is a distinction. It's a little bit of a distinction without a difference here, in that the rate does provide the revenue requirement. If the revenue requirement changes, then that rate will change.
That's at that point you would be calling them interim, yes.
And so that's why this is today an interim rate.
Until you approve a revenue requirement, yes.
Chair Johnson, may I just, I agree with Mr. Rizloff on every point, and I just want to say this so that we're all absolutely clear what we're requesting. I think as a practical matter, the point is, whatever we want to call them, if you change rate design but not revenue requirements, nothing changes during this period. So I just don't want you to be left with the impression that if you leave revenue requirements for final rates alone, but change rate design, that we're going to go back and change rate design during this period. And that's why, if I may say, one of the benefits is that you've seen this rate design, albeit it wasn't you, it was somebody in 1987, looked at the rate design we have. Well, and Mr. Rizloff may take issue with that. I understand what you're saying, that there's maybe some changes that have occurred, but at least what we're using is something that has received commission approval. If you did nothing, we'd still have the rate design I'm proposing here. I mean, so we're still using this rate design. It is an effort I'm having to vouch in why we're using this and not just saying let's pick numbers out of the air and impose them, which would be more what the statute had anticipated. This, I think, is a more consistent method. We're not – Mr. Rizloff and I are absolutely on the same page, though. If a rate design change is made in final rates, it would not require adjustment going backward, and in that way – we're asking for a permanent rate design for the interim period that would be changed only if revenue requirements change.
But I don't think anybody disputes that. I'm just saying by making it sound like permanent rates, I think we oversell. Permanent rates means you can't ever call them back. I mean, and I understand rate design, no matter what happens with rate design, that does not affect. But if revenue requirement changes, this money could be rebated, it could be refunded to the customers.
I think this is what we say would be a natural difference between a commissioner and an analyst.
Mr. Rizloff, I don't know exactly what you mean by that, but the bottom line is the increase to the customer may not be 10.34% at the end of the day, regardless of what we decide. Yeah, presumably in the next minute or two. That, to me, has a very interim quality to it.
Truthfully, it's not going to be 10.43 on anybody at any time unless it's strictly a coincidence. But I understand your point. I'm just saying, for purposes of designing rates and looking at revenue requirements and what the analysts are going to have to go through once this is completed, and I think we've covered this enough, but they will consider it, you know, whatever takes effect, if you approve the stipulation to be a permanent change for that period, they won't have to go back and revisit it. That's all I mean.
Other comments? Hearing none, any commission action?
Let me make sure I got my question right, but... I'm going to have to find my... Okay, EL08-030. I'll motion that the Commission approve Otter Tail's request for implementation of interim rates based on its existing rate design and proration method.
Motion having been made does not require... Sorry. Okay. Is there any discussion on the motion?
No, I do not.
No discussion on the motion. We'll proceed to vote. Hansen.
Yes.
Kolbeck.
Aye.
Johnson votes yes. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much. All right. With that, we will attempt to get Ms. Moore on the telephone. We do. We're working on it.
I was okay with it, and then I shouldn't have asked that last question. And then I'm like, I get it. It just depends on what's best for the customer.
Meredith?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Ms. Moore, for your patience.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
Technology, of course, has its shortcomings. With that, we are at telecom item number two, which does deal with Mid-Continent Communications filing for approval to provide local exchange service in a rural service area. The questions before the commission today are, first, shall it approve the confidential stipulation for partial settlement? And additionally, shall the commission amend Mid-Continent Communications Certificate of Authority to allow Mid-Continent to provide local exchange service in the rural exchange areas of Crooks and Baltic? With that, we've had parties file a stipulation. Who would like to take the first shot?
This light looks like it's on when it's not. Mr. Chairman, I was just waiting for everyone to get out of the room. What we have before the commission is a settlement in which the parties have basically agreed that there is a July 1st date upon which Alliance would start providing video services in the Crooks and Baltic exchanges. And so rather than litigating all of this, we just agreed that when July 1st rolls around, we'll both flip our switches at the same time, and that's the way things will work. There is a clause in the stipulation that says that if for some reason Alliance determines that they can finish sooner than July 1st, then we would, everything that's agreed upon in the stipulation would move forward to that date. But our understanding is, at least at this point, is that it's pretty much a July 1st situation. And I think Ms. Moore is on the line, and she can certainly correct me if I'm wrong.
Ms. Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Gerdes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would concur with Mr. Gerdes's remarks with regard to the stipulation. This was essentially an effort on behalf of both parties to take into consideration the legal and practical realities that both parties faced, as well as the issues that we know we presented to the commission, none of which had really great answers under the circumstances. And what essentially Alliance has agreed to in this particular instance is that July 1 is the presumptive date on which it will provide cable, with the exception of if Alliance does have the ability to do so sooner, we are required to provide reasonable notice of that to MIDCO, such that we can start discussions with regard to an interconnection agreement and everything that necessarily follows in that particular analysis. So in both parties' beliefs, I think what we did here was try to put the best face on what was a difficult situation, and we think that this is in the best interest of both parties and likely in the interest of the commission, too, because it allows us to forgo litigation of something that would have had an end at some point in time and likely resulted in essentially a waste of everyone's time and effort. So we think the stipulation is the best that the parties can do at this point in time, and we would simply ask that the commission approve it.
Staff, comments.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. This is Terry Labrie Baker with staff. Staff does not object to the stipulation and would recommend that the commission approve it. With that, also the pending amended COA, staff has reviewed the filing for that to include the Baltic and Crooks, South Dakota, pursuant to South Dakota Codified Law 49-31-69. Mid-Continent has asked for confidential treatment of their financials as well as a waiver of ARSD 2010-3218. Staff would therefore recommend granting the amended COA to include the geographic areas of Baltic and Crooks exchanges and granting confidential treatment of Mid-Continent's financials with the proposed effective date of July 1 or an earlier date as Alliance would provide video programming.
And also including the waiver that you mentioned. The motion should include approving the waiver.
Yep, the commission can certainly grant that waiver as long as we specify the geographic areas of Baltic and Crooks. I think the waiver isn't necessary, but to cover all the bases, if you want to include the waiver.
Oh, I see. I see what you're doing.
Then you can certainly do that.
That's fine. No, that's fine. I didn't pick that up when you said it, but I'm with you now.
With respect to the waiver.
Yeah, let's wait till we get you on the mic there, Mr. Coit.
Well, I think, yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, I mean, when we intervened in this case, I mean, there were two things that we, you know, were really our areas of primary concern. One dealt with, the, you know, the rural interconnection exemption, and with respect to any sort of expiration of that, you know, given the fact that Alliance was looking at video. So that was one issue. And as you know from our past involvement in proceedings and COAs, we've always been very concerned about the rural safeguards. One of the rural safeguards is the additional service obligations that are imposed on CLEX entering rural markets. And that waiver has to deal with those rural safeguards. So I guess from the standpoint of keeping things, I think, consistent with what the rules say with respect to, you know, rural safeguards, I would think that unless Midco intends to provide service throughout the entirety, and I'm not exactly sure, you know, what Ms. LaBrie Baker meant by just Brooks and, or by referencing Crooks and Baltic, but if they're not intending on providing service outside of those town areas, then I do think that, you know, there should be some commission action with respect to the waiver request, because there is a public interest determination that you would have to waive.
But my understanding is that you are according to your COA, you've asked for authority in those two, the entirety of those two exchanges, isn't that correct?
We have asked for the authority to serve the entirety of those exchanges and for a waiver from the requirement that we serve the rural parts of those exchanges. It's the same scenario that we had in Webster and in Wabe.
That wasn't my understanding. I guess I didn't see the rural exemption waiver.
That's in our application, yeah.
Can you show us where?
I can.
Because in your amended application for a waiver of March 17, it says provide local exchange service in the Crooks and Baltic exchanges of Alliance.
Well, and then somewhere in there, or it may have been on a separate filing, we said to the extent that
sit, grab the mic.
I think if you read the question, Karen, it says on October 9th, 2008, Midco filed a motion to find rural exemption waived.
Yeah.
If that helps you.
On what?
It's in the on the agenda.
Right, but they filed an amendment.
So I don't know if the date helps you find it or not.
But they filed an amended application for a waiver, so that's the one I was looking at.
Oh.
Right, and your waiver refers to the extent that service of less than the entire Alliance study area requires a waiver. There's nothing about the rural areas of the two exchanges you asked for, Brooks and Baltic. You're saying you're seeking authority to provide local exchange service in Crooks and Baltic exchanges. So where do you ask for a waiver of the rural areas of Crooks and Baltic?
I do not have that file with me. And so I'm at a loss, and I apologize. I didn't bring the file with me.
Well, in your original request, in your original application of page 5, you say Midcontinent requests such a waiver under ARSD 2010-3218. At the present time, Midcontinent applies only to provide local exchange services in the Crooks and Baltics exchanges. So you've always referred to it as the whole exchange. I don't recall ever seeing anything different than that. So
I don't either.
You may be right. There may have been a poor choice of words.
So you don't intend to serve the entire exchanges? You only
just the non-rural parts of the exchange. Yes. I apologize. I didn't bring that part of the file with me, so I can't be as intelligent as I wish I could. I mean,
I'm assuming Ms. Moore, that was okay with Alliance then?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I thought it was the other way around. I thought, much like you did in reading it, that the intention was to serve the entirety of the Crooks and Baltic, but that they were seeking an exemption from having to serve outside of those areas.
Yeah,
so I too didn't have that impression, I guess.
So do you object to the commission allowing them to serve only the cities?
It's not something, it's something that I've discussed with my client, and essentially what he had instructed me to do was simply to allow the commission to make the determination that it believes to be appropriate under the facts and the circumstances, and simply to hold Mid-Continent to the requirements of the rules. So I won't object or agree in any way, shape, or form with the request.
What we want to do is the same thing we did in Wabe and Webster. And in those instances, we served the cities and not the rural parts of the exchanges.
If I could just comment on this a little bit. This is something that has been unclear to SDTA kind of throughout this process. I'm not exactly sure how. At some point in time, I kind of came to the impression that they were actually that they did not have any intentions of serving the rural customers within those exchanges, and that waiver request, at least in part, was for that. It looks like from the text, I maybe didn't get that. I guess that's kind of been my understanding, probably based more on past history. With respect to this particular issue, though, from a rural ILEC perspective, when this issue comes up with respect to whether a CLEC should be required to serve outside of the town area, the ILECs are kind of caught in a difficult place, because if they really push that rural safeguard, and then that CLEC, actually decides to bill out or resell in those areas, the question then becomes, have they met ETC obligations, and can they pursue federal universal service funding? Because at that point, they're providing service throughout an area that might qualify them for ETC status. So as an ILEC, it's a really difficult question. And kind of what I found, based on the history is that when you present that question to the ILECs, certainly they'd like to see competitors, play by the same rules in terms of, carrier of last resort obligations and so forth. But there's a lot more to it when you put USF into the equation. And from an SDTA perspective, we believe those rural safeguards have some worth and some value, and that they're important. At the same time, though, when it comes to the question of, whether they're going to be pursued to the hilt or not, that to me is more of an individual ILEC position. And they've got to make that determination. So from that perspective, whatever, Alliance's position is on this issue with respect to the waiver, we would concur with what their position is, because it's really an individual company call. I don't know if that helps or not.
The only thing, this is Karen Kramer from staff, that I would add is in TC07057, which is Mid-Continent's approval to expand its COA into the Gayville, and it was captioned the Gayville Rural Service Area. What the commission ultimately did there was they ordered the amended certificate of authority, and it said to provide competitive local exchange service in the city of Gayville, and then it also ordered that ARSD 2010-3215 shall be waived pursuant to ARSD 2010-3218, and then it was just confidential treatment. But So I suppose, you know, that might be an option.
I think if the alliance isn't objecting, I think the commission can determine that the area, the geographic area, because the rule itself references the commission determining the geographic area. I don't have the rule in front of me right now. And so to that extent, if alliance isn't objecting, the commission can determine that the geographic area is the what, city limits then of those two cities? Is that what you're requesting?
Right. Yes.
Right. So we have to determine what the service requirements are, the ETC requirements, and we need to determine what the geographic area is. And the commission could determine that is the geographic area.
Is that geographic area frozen as Weist, or as cities grow, does that...
It depends on how the order is written, of course. If it says the city limits, I would assume that then that would expand to include the city limits if the city, you know, obviously annexes.
From SDTA's perspective, I think, you know, that's probably the best way to handle this. Is just look at, you know, the certificate, the authority, the area of authority. I mean, if you don't do that, then you do have to, in our opinion, it would be appropriate to address the waiver issue, but shouldn't be necessary if there's a limitation to city limits.
Although a waiver would do the same thing, right? We're just trying to decide semantically how to, okay.
Yeah, I think either way would work.
I wonder, since that rule, though, establishes, it's probably better to waive the rule, isn't it? To the extent that the rule requires a company to do something, isn't it better to waive that requirement?
The rule actually gives the commission the authority to determine the geographic area.
Oh, does it? Okay. Well, then, yeah.
Throughout a geographic area as determined by the commission, unless a waiver is. So I you could probably do it either way, but if you want to say it's a waiver, that's fine. But.
Potato, potato.
Yeah.
Other questions?
We get to the same point.
All right, well, let's try to put this together, shall we? I would first move the commission approve the confidential stipulation. Okay.
For partial settlement?
Added to me at the last minute. It's maybe not. I don't know. Okay. Okay. The commission approved the confidential stipulation for partial settlement, and in addition, that the commission amend Mid-Continent's certificate of authority to allow Mid-Continent to provide local exchange service only within the city limits of Crooks and Baltic, certainly subject to the stipulation that is part of that motion.
Could we take that in two motions?
Sure. The first would be, shall the commission approve the confidential stipulation? Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Now we'll deal with Mid-Continent COA. The motion, is there a motion?
I'll motion that in TCO 8105 that the commission will amend Mid-Continent Communications COA to allow Mid-Continent to provide local exchange service in the rural exchange areas of Crooks and Baltic, South Dakota, confining the geographic location to the city limits of Baltic and Crooks.
And are there any other portions of the stipulation, I wonder, that should be...
You might want to say subject to stipulation and staff
certification. I was just thinking that in my head, that at the end of that motion, that service needs to be, after service has been provided and subject to the stipulation.
Staff's recommendations.
Staff's recommendations.
Motion has been made. Discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'm wondering whether my concerns, I'm trying to balance all of my concerns here with the motion as well as articulated as it was. I I recognize that there is, to an extent, an exception here because this particular part of the state is not as sparsely populated as other areas. However, I am challenged when we have exceptions for CLEX to come in and basically compete in those areas where I'm concerned with cherry picking, cream skimming, etc. And as I said, I recognize this is probably not the perfect type of situation just because of the population centers that are around it. However, I'm still challenged to support it, and that's why I asked that it be bifurcated so that we had two questions to consider. And I don't have a huge heartburn over it. I just it's the precedent of the fact that we have a situation like a few other rural states where that last mile of service is going to be challenged, and at what juncture do we cripple those entities that are actually trying to serve them? And I just am concerned that we get into that with this. Thank you.
Yeah, I think those points are well made. Certainly some concerns, and I think I would probably have articulated even more concerns than maybe you did if there hadn't been some precedent for this with Webster, Wabe, and Gayville. But you're right, this is quite abnormal, or not typical anyway. Other comments?
Well, I hope that it was stated in my motion, though, that Alliance needs to have service provided first, and also Mid-Continent would have to meet the joint stipulation before they could ever go in and offer service. So I guess that kind of puts my mind at ease that Alliance will have to have violated, not violated, that's probably a bad word, but we'll have to have forfeited the rural exemption first and provided service, so that would allow Mid-Continent to come in.
Any other comments? All right. Hearing none, we have a motion pending. We'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye. Hansen?
No.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 2-1. Is there any further business to come before the commission today? Nobody's listening, so we should have said it at the beginning, but we do have May 11th through the 13th, a very exciting energy conference, Crisis or Renaissance, being organized by Commissioner Hansen, and we would pull that announcement out above all the others. Thanks much. We'll stand adjourned.